those spaces. Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, will be with me a little later in the programme. It's Thursday, so of course Mystery Hour will provide some much-needed light relief. But we begin with anything but. We begin with the grooming inquiry, the enormous problems that it has already encountered, the worst possible outcome of something that we touched on yesterday, and a question that nobody seems able to answer.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, ministers have rallied behind Jess Phillips after she faced calls to resign over the grooming gang inquiry. Four abuse survivors say they would only consider returning to an oversight panel if the safeguarding minister steps down. She is under huge pressure to get the process back on track. The Conservative frontbencher Sir James Cleverly has rejected claims the Tories are playing politics.
Our job is to hold the government to account. We feel very strongly that they have not conducted this well or professionally at all. They delayed, they did everything to try and avoid a national inquiry. Unfortunately, there have been accusations of bad faith applied towards us.
The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says a ceasefire is still possible with additional pressure on Russia. Mr. Zelensky, who is attending a summit in Brussels, has welcomed new US and EU sanctions on Moscow. President Trump's controls target Russia's two largest oil companies. Personal finance analyst Alice Haynes says it's likely to complicate the energy market.
We've already seen that starting to happen after the UK imposed sanctions on the two oil majors last week. Crude oil prices rose more than 4% on expectations that the move would cut off Russian supplies to the global market. These two Russian oil firms export 3.1 million barrels of oil per day.
A government minister has defended the one-in, one-out returns deal with France. It's emerged a man's re-entered the UK on a small boat after being deported. The children's minister, Josh McAllister, says it shows the scheme is working, as he'll be sent back again and again. The King and Queen are arriving at the Vatican to meet Pope Leo. The monarch and pontiff will pray together in the Sistine Chapel in a display of unity between the Catholic Church and Church of England. And the latest audience figures show LBC reaches 3.3 million people across the UK. And thank you, because 1.4 million listeners are tuning in to James O'Brien every week. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was up 35 points at 95.50. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 15. LBC weather, heavy rain and strong winds for many parts of the country as the storm moves in, but drier in the north and west. A high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
That there is a great night's sleep. And when Susan wakes up, she's going to get to enjoy a delicious unlimited breakfast. Or, if that super comfy bed is just too hard to leave, Susan can enjoy a midday checkout. Get better sleep for your money. Book now at Premier Inn. Breakfast subject to availability. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Three minutes after 10 is the time. A very good morning indeed to you. This is a horrible story, and it is one that we should talk about, one that we have to talk about, but one that you sometimes find yourself feeling a little bit reluctant to talk about, because the discourse has been so hideously polluted. I'm not going to make light of anything today, but don't shoot me down in flames for saying this, but despite the sort of weird aberration of his sort of slavish support for Boris Johnson, I've always found James Cleverly to be a fairly stand-up guy. And I don't think he's been completely honest with himself when he says that the Conservatives are not trying to score political points over the grooming inquiry. The abject failure to do anything in that space for 14 years, and of course, the abject failure to enact 18 out of 20 of Baroness Jay's recommendations in the much broader inquiry into child sexual abuse do not speak of particular enthusiasm in this space. When she was Women's and Equalities Minister, I don't think Kemi Badenoch met a single victim of this peculiar and particular type of grooming, which, and I don't make any apology to people who find some of these words unhelpful or unpleasant or difficult to deal with, that you're talking about gang-based sexual abuse of girls and young women undertaken by men who were known to each other and from very similar or identical Pakistani backgrounds. There's a particular region when we first started talking about it that was identified to me as being hugely disproportionate in the sort of geographical origins of some of the families that these men come from. But of course, I'm one of those people who doesn't consider these crimes to be any more disgusting or any more heinous than identical crimes committed by people of a different colour or of a different background. And that's why the discourse is difficult, because some people clearly care a heck of a lot more. And the reason why they care a heck of a lot more is based on race and ethnicity and, of course, religion. And that's why the question underpinning the entire inquiry seems to me to be missing from almost all of the considerations. It's a tough one, this. I've thought long and hard about whether or not I'd ask you this question, but I think it's really, really important. We mentioned yesterday that Jim Gamble would probably be the best head of the inquiry. He was the only name left in the hat by breakfast time yesterday, and by tea time yesterday, he had taken his own name out of the hat for precisely the reason that we predicted yesterday, pointing out that it's a job no one in their right mind would want to take because they are on a hiding to nothing whatever they do. And the reason why they're on a hiding to nothing whatever they do is the source of the question that I'm about to ask you. So Jim Gamble talking about political point scoring, talking about the atmosphere in the House of Commons where people are not prioritizing the welfare of the victims. They are prioritizing at the moment an opportunity to, for example, get rid of Jess Phillips, which has been called for by four victims, at which point the tone of this conversation changes, because I'm not minded or in any way keen to challenge their analysis of events, except to say that asking somebody if they want something is not the same as telling somebody that they will have to do something. If I say to you, would you like this inquiry to broaden its remit? And you say to me, no, I would not. That is not proof, evidence, or even close to the case that you are being told that it will. And that, coupled with slight fears of people being taken advantage of for political reasons, is why even the Jess Phillips angle today feels like a hideously complicated business. But Jim Gamble has pulled his own name out of the hat for the very simple reason that the entire discourse has been turned into something so feverish and febrile. Here he is talking to Nick a little bit earlier today.
The petty politicking that you're seeing in the margins is also not helpful. And I know James Cleverly is coming on after me, so he'll have the benefit of speaking without reply from me. But ultimately, I would think politicians, all of whom who have been aware of this for a long, long time, would realise that using victims and survivors to score points off one another in the House of Commons isn't going to build anyone's confidence. So they all need to get in a room, lead by example. Well, everyone wants this inquiry to take place. So let's get consensus amongst the politicians. Let's have a system whereby perhaps there's a select committee that you can bring prospective chairs before and do that in a public and transparent way so that decisions can be made in the best interest of the inquiry, in the best interest of survivors, and without the toxicity that's begun to build in the margins.
So why has it become toxic? Why is Jim Gamble describing the inquiry as toxic, if not because some people have tried very, very hard to turn it into an opportunity to score political points? But there's a question that you're not quite going to believe you haven't been asked before, or you haven't heard anybody answer. And the question is this: what does success look like? So let me provide some speculative answers to that question. We know that for some people, success would involve every Muslim in the country being somehow held responsible for or complicit in these hideous crimes. We know that. I mean, those people, they kind of run Twitter now. We know that for some people, success in this inquiry would involve everybody brown being somehow held responsible or complicit for these crimes. And we know that there's absolutely no way on earth that that can happen. Kind of people who bowdlerize the Quran and claim that it perhaps somehow compels people to commit these hideous crimes, or that every Muslim in the country is required to behave in this hideous fashion, is so obviously ridiculous and repellent. But it is the driving force for an awful lot of the loudest voices that have moved into this space since we first started talking about it in 2011. So they are not going to get what they want, and they are people who, and I'm talking now about public figures and politicians, not about victims, they are people who, when the inquiry does not conclude that all Muslims are a problem, will shout cover up and shame and all the usual nonsense that sees them strangely adjacent to movements like the anti-vax lobby and various other evidence-free positions. So you're not going to get the Islamophobic result that many people clearly want. And then you come to the victims. In most cases, people whose abusers have been brought to justice, and their complaint is either that they were not brought to justice enough or quickly enough, or that people who were contributors to the slowness of that process have not been accounted for. This is where the claims of cover-up come in, that social workers and police didn't do enough. And this is where I have my biggest problem. Anybody who looked the other way in this kind of case should be named and shamed, for want of a more helpful phrase. But I don't know how that will work. I don't know how that will work. If you're talking about, this is good from Ben, he's taking the words straight out of my mouth. So the point I'd make is that the people who most wanted it, the inquiry, believe that there are still many people out there who need to be brought to justice, in which case you don't need an inquiry, you need more criminal investigation. So this inquiry is not going to convict culprits. It is not designed to convict culprits. It's designed to establish where errors were made, investigatory and protection, child protection errors were made. And what do you do with that information? I'll tell you something that I think you already know. But women and young girls who've been victims of sexual abuse, whether gang-based or by their own fathers, have been let down by society and by the system in this country forever. Not for decades, not for years, not for months, forever. And if these women and these young women and girls have been even more let down because of fears of being accused of racism or fears of being accused of discrimination, then that's absolutely awful. But who on earth is going to be able to draw that line? Police officers have been found to be involved in the abuse in some cases. They are probably the ones that are going to shout, "We were worried about being called racist," the loudest. How is an inquiry going to prove that? I've put so much on Louise Casey's shoulders. I was thinking about this last night. Because Louise Casey said it was worth having another inquiry, even after the Alexis J inquiry, even after the massive one, which made 20 huge recommendations, of which 18 have still been ignored. I just found myself thinking Louise Casey is clearly one of the good guys. She has, covered herself in glory in almost every job she's ever done. And she says we need an inquiry. She says it's worth having. And that's good enough for me. But she is just one person. And the more this goes on, and the more the usual suspects try to turn it into an opportunity to attack Keir Starmer, who's done more in this space as DPP than anybody else in the country. Listen, that's not an opinion, that's counting. He really has. As DPP, he reopened cases. He sent allegations back to be re-examined. He's put Nasir Afzal up in the northwest of England on speed dial, as it were, with the mission to delve deeply into all of this and find out more and get more people in court. Cases that, of course, in some circumstances were nearly brought to disastrous early closures by the kind of characters who claim that they're acting on behalf of the victims. The self-interest, quick, make a donation to my Patreon. I'm about to commit a contempt of court outside a case that is actually going ahead and that I only know about because it's in the news. But hey, they're not telling you about it. You know all that already. You know all that. So they haven't got anyone to head it up. They were the only two candidates scheduled for interviews with survivors. Most survivors seem happy with the process. I think there are 30 on the panel. Four have withdrawn, and they've now said they'll go back if Jess Phillips is removed from the equation. But what does that do to the wishes of the 26 who are still, if you like, part of the process? And who on earth would want to take this job? Unless we can come up with a fairly clear characterization of what success would look like. Isn't that insane? That all of this newsprint, pages of it, PMQs yesterday dedicated to it, not once did anybody really talk about what success would look like. What is it designed to do? I am terrified that there's no outcome I can think of that would satisfy the victims, which is all I care about. I certainly don't care about the people who are desperate to have it turned into some sort of weapon in a race war. That's why people like Elon Musk get involved. All I care about is the victims feeling that retrospectively they have at least received some fairness and justice that was denied to them at the time. But if they are in the preferable position of having already seen their culprits, their abusers jailed, then what does success look like in the context of the inquiry? It's a really tricky question, this. And I want to know what you think. That's all. Because I can't currently find much optimism that this inquiry is going to deliver what anybody wants. But most importantly, what the victims want, and not just the ones on the panel, of course, not just the ones involved in the inquiry, but all of them. All of them. And if you were the other senior ex-police chief with experience of tackling child abuse, currently, I read, being urged to put your name forward, would you? Would you put your name forward? Given that the accusation or the allegations against Jim Gamble and against woman who'd been a social worker who withdrew earlier, Hudson, I think Anne Hudson, given that the allegation against them is that they can't possibly be honest because of their past jobs, because these young women were let down by police and social services, they can't conceive of anybody from police and social services doing the job. That means almost that nobody can. And that's where I think, I don't even want to say reluctance, it would feel indecent to criticise the victims who are unhappy with the way things are going. But if their position is, we can't trust any police officers and we can't trust anyone who's ever worked for social services, you're left with the question of who you can trust, because you can put judges on that hook as well. We were let down by the criminal justice system, so I don't want anyone from the criminal justice system. We were let down by the police, so I don't want the inquiry to be conducted by anyone from the police. We were let down by social services, so I don't want the inquiry to be chaired by anyone from social services. Who's left? Can't be a politician, for obvious reasons. I don't know what a satisfactory candidate would look like. We can say a judge, albeit that the judicial system has let many of these people down. But as Keir Starmer explained yesterday, that slows down processes and also could, in some cases, delay actual criminal trials, criminal investigations into other cases of this kind of grooming. I'm happy or prepared to believe Keir Starmer on that. I don't see how it wouldn't be true or why he'd say it if it wasn't. But I don't have the law. I don't have the expertise. Happily, he does. So, what would success look like in the context of this inquiry? I really want it. Let me be absolutely clear about that. And I'm worried that I'm putting too much on Louise Casey. If it wasn't Louise Casey who had said we should have it, and there is therefore a realistic chance of success, I probably would have been closer to the position that let's just enact Alexis J's things first. Let's deal with this. Let's deal with that. Let's pursue some of these scumbags through the courts who haven't already been pursued through the courts. But no, she said the inquiry was a good idea, so Keir Starmer has instituted it. What would success look like? Okay? Hit the numbers now. You will get through. And I really think it's extraordinary that we haven't asked each other this question before. Do we even know what success would look like? If you are, God forbid, part of this process, part of this story, if you have been a victim of this kind of abuse, then if it's not about bringing your abusers to justice, which it's categorically not, that's not what this is about, then what do you think it is about? Help the rest of us understand why there is so much more to this than simple sentences. You want something back from society that was taken away from you by society. But the problem seems to be today that you can't trust anybody from that society to chair the inquiry. 0345 6060 973 is the number that you need. Why is it toxic, as Jim Gamble said, as he withdrew himself from consideration for the role of heading the inquiry? He has described it as toxic. A man set to lead it has described the inquiry itself as toxic. Why is it toxic? 0345 6060 973. How do you detoxify it? But crucially, what would a happy resolution, a successful resolution look like? Because I'm really sorry, I've been talking about these criminals, these abusers, these poor girls and young women for 15 years, and I don't know what success would look like in the context of this inquiry. I really hope you do. 0345 6060 973.
LBC.
Business healthcare. Sounds pricey.
At Benenden Health, it's less than £16 per employee per month, which
will go up when people use it.
Actually, no. We don't do price hikes each time our services are used. Just
medical questionnaires for everyone.
No. And it's quick and easy to join.
Sounds great. I'm in.
Benenden Health. Healthcare done different. Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Selected surgical procedures. Immediate access for businesses. Wait periods apply for personal membership. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Top up on island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours too. I. Inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with...
Think. Do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
Play Set for Life from the National Lottery. Winners get 10k every month for 30 years. You could win on repeat. Set for Life. Play now on the National Lottery app. Terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Bring your pensions together into one easy-to-manage online plan with PensionBee. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
23 minutes after 10 is the time. Grooming inquiry is toxic, says police chief lined up to lead it. Fresh turmoil as candidate for chair quits toxic grooming gang inquiry. Grooming victims say minister should quit. The headlines keep on coming. And the short list of people currently under consideration to lead the inquiry consists now of precisely nobody. So, surely it's a morning or a moment to ask each other what we want this inquiry to achieve, and or crucially, what we want the inquiry to achieve for the victims. 30 of whom, currently down to 26, are involved in it. But, of course, the idea that they all speak with one voice is patronising and ridiculous. Chris is in Hanwell to kick things off. Chris, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. As a guy, I can't help but feel inadequately qualified to have an opinion, so thank you for having me on. But I do think, as somebody with no skin in the game, the only successful outcome for the inquiry would be to have an independent body set up by women, made of women, potentially survivors, that could be approached or reached out to by girls who could potentially be in the same situation again to stop it happening. The forces or the...
But we could do that now.
Well,
we don't need an inquiry for that.
No, but that would be the... or possibly the best outcome, because what's happened has happened. And as it's generally males in the police force and people wanting to turn a blind eye, potentially, it may well happen again. So the only successful way to potentially or most likely to stop it happening again would be to have somebody that the...
No, I understand your point. I understand your point, but there's absolutely no need for an inquiry to establish what you describe.
Maybe not. But
no, it's fine. I'm not. It's not a criticism. It's just. I mean, we are wondering what we want on behalf of victims. What we want the inquiry to establish, and that's about facts. It may well be that you can then use the facts to construct something new for the future. But the idea of I don't fully buy into your gender distinction either. You know, the people responsible for turning a blind eye or for failing to properly investigate in these cases and in countless others are more likely to be men simply by dint of the makeup of the forces, but the social workers are more likely to be women. And the prosecutors, in the case of Nazir Afzal, is a Muslim man who's done more in this space than probably any other lawyer in the country. So I'm just not, again, not a criticism, but just perhaps an illustration of the difficulty of identifying what success would look like. And there's no embarrassment in not being able to. I mean, I want calls, obviously. I want to talk to people. But it may well be that we won't, by 11 o'clock today, have any clearer picture of what success would look like. And that is probably what Jim Gamble's talking about when he describes it as toxic. Because Kemi Badenoch yesterday wasn't really displaying much interest in the victims. She was trying to use it as a weapon with which to hurt Keir Starmer. Ditto Jess Phillips. It's obscenely naive to think that we could somehow remove this from party politics, but unless you can, it stays toxic. You should probably even stop pointing out that the Tories had 14 years to do something and didn't. They did absolutely nothing. They were led by a man, and remember that people like James Cleverly, Kemi Badenoch, bent the knee to Boris Johnson. They were led by a man who feels that investigations into historic child sexual abuse are complete wastes of money. But I guess you probably, if you wanted to move truly towards truth and reconciliation, you would have to stop making points like that as well. Everybody comes together, agrees on what they want, and works together to achieve it. Maybe that could have happened pre-Brexit or back when two political parties could talk to each other in a civil fashion, but I don't see that happening here. Richard is in Martin Hussingtree, delightful Worcestershire village. Richard, what would you like to say?
Hello, morning. Thanks for having me on. You've just solidified a lot of what's in my mind. I think the going right to the top of what should be achieved, however it's done, what should be achieved is that victims in the future should be listened to, should know they're getting a fair hearing, and this never ever happen again. It doesn't matter. So the perpetrators are in prison, as you've said. I'm not really interested in what their background is or anything like that, but if we have to look at this dispassionately and unpolitically. I know I've just heard what you've said about how bloody difficult that is, because people just can't have sensible conversations with each other anymore. And we need to look at it and go, right, what caused it, and deal with the root causes, and maybe an independent judge. I don't think it needs to be a man or a woman. It just needs...
Problem with the root causes, and I mean, I think you're closer to something concrete than the last fella, but the problem there is that we know what the root causes are. The root causes...
Get on and deal with it, then.
Historically, well, then you don't need an inquiry.
I agree.
Oh, no, I want an inquiry.
No one's got the guts, but nobody's got the guts nowadays to go, we don't need an inquiry, because I think a lot of us in general public, we don't really want to be led anymore, so we don't want to be told we don't need an inquiry. But have we got faith that whatever a reparatory action that takes place will take place and is woken up again? And I don't think we have.
We've got a long and hideous history of ignoring accusers, disbelieving accusers, and blaming accusers in this country. And this was the biggest takeaway from the Alexis J inquiry, from the child sex abuse inquiry that covered all manner of areas of life in this country, including one of my old schools. And you know, that is institutional change to tell victims coming forward that they will be believed. But then, of course, one victim comes forward who turns out to be a liar, and that becomes the only story in town for years. So you've got the historic misogyny, and then you've got the possibility, probability, even perhaps certainty, that there were some people who were frightened of grasping this particular nettle because of community issues or fears of perceived racism. But, of course, that doesn't touch the sides of the historical examples of women and young girls being treated with contempt by the system. So what the inquiry... I mean, I can agree with you about what the outcome could and should be. I don't yet find myself in a position of saying we don't need an inquiry or we don't want an inquiry. But the question of what the inquiry is going to find out that would constitute success, I don't think either of us know, do we?
No, I don't think we do. But you then go back to, well, so how do we do that?
And yeah.
It's a change of mindset, behaviour. It's almost, I mean, I agree with everything you've just said about historical factors. This is such a broad societal problem that it touches on things like racism, integration, it talks on men's behaviour, women's behaviour, authorities' behaviour. It's a lot broader. The change for this not to happen again touches so many different things. Mm. And unless you go to those things, and we've got to draw a line. You've got if we argue about, not you and I, but if we societally, if we argue about, they did that wrong and they did this wrong, I go, okay, right. So if you were to design this from scratch, it's almost how do you design that, and how should the authority act in such a way that it's fair to all?
And what you've just said is the elephant in the room. Because it is correct that they focus in this inquiry on a particular type of abuse by men of largely Pakistani heritage operating in gangs. That is what the inquiry is into. But it doesn't, of course, address the massive majority of victims of sexual abuse in this country who feel that their case hasn't been handled properly or respectfully. The massive majority. I don't think it's disproportionate to focus on this because it's a very peculiar and particular type of crime. But, you know, if you were the victim of child sexual abuse at the hands of a gang of white people or at the hands of a family group or at the hands of anybody who isn't part of an Asian grooming gang, then you could be forgiven for feeling a little bit ignored or a little bit left out of the process and left out of the conversation. Because Alexis J's inquiry was designed to address your plight, and her findings have been almost entirely ignored. That's the point I keep coming back to, because I haven't seen a will among society, not just politicians, governments, whichever party is in power, that the will in society doesn't seem to be there. Because if it was, we would be manning the barricades until every single one of the J Inquiry's recommendations had been enacted. And the current total is, if you're not familiar, 2 out of 20. Thomas Watts has your headlines.
Ministers have rallied behind Jess Phillips after she faced calls to resign over the grooming gang inquiry. 4 abuse survivors say they'd only consider returning to an oversight panel if the safeguarding minister steps down. The US and EU have announced new sanctions on the Russian energy sector. The White House says it's the result of Moscow's lack of serious commitment to a peace process to end the war in Ukraine. The King and Queen are at the Vatican to meet Pope Leo. The monarch and pontiff will pray together in the Sistine Chapel in a display of unity between the Catholic Church and Church of England. LBC weather, heavy rain and strong winds for many parts of England and Wales, drier in northern and western areas, a high of 13 degrees.
LBC.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the media business. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Atina, a media business student in year 12.
Being a young creative at Global Academy means that I get to turn my passion into a career. From studying creative enterprise, I've already learnt how to market my own business and gain knowledge about the business side of the industry.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 60 60973.
10:35 is the time. It is the story that dominates the news agenda at the moment, and particularly the political news, which is perhaps part of the problem. But the question that hasn't been answered satisfactorily is, what do we want the grooming gang inquiry to achieve? We know what some of the loudest voices want. They want it to be turned into a demonisation of everybody of a certain faith or a certain ethnicity, and that is categorically and palpably impossible, because it would involve lies on a scale that even Donald Trump would balk at. For victims, particularly the ones whose abusers have been brought to justice, they want the people that stymied the process, slowed the process, or let them down to be, well, what? To be identified? I'm not sure that you can be charged with doing your job badly. I don't know what the level, what the criteria, the threshold would be for a social worker or a police officer to be facing sanction. And a lot of them, of course, will not be in the jobs that they were doing at the time anymore. Some of the women have alleged that they were raped by the policeman they reported the crimes to, which perhaps explains why there's a reluctance to have a police officer or a former police officer heading up the inquiry. You can't blame them for not wanting police to be running the investigation, given what we know about the police broad record of covering up their own wrongdoings. So what would that actually involve? Jaswinda is in Leeds. Jaswinda, what would you like to say?
Good morning, James.
Hello.
Hi. I think the first rule of any engagement with victim survivors has to be to develop an environment where survivors feel safe, respected and supported. They've got to be at the heart of the planning decision-making of this. And the fact that four have stepped down and shared their experience of it being a fearful, toxic environment, it's something you cannot move away from.
No.
And can I just say that I am myself a survivor, okay? I'm the founder of the charity Carmen of Honour. So basically, for 30 years of campaigning, one of the issues that I had in terms of bringing to the fore the issues of child marriage, forced marriage, was the fact that professionals often looked the other way because they were too afraid to tackle it. They were too afraid to deal with it. One, for the fear of causing offence. Two, the fear of being called a racist. I never forget the helpline, the national helpline, a police officer calling the helpline and saying, you are the people that deal with the cultural issues, aren't you? That's what you do. And the call handler's listening. Yes, officer, how can I help? Well, I've got this 13-year-old, I've got this old man with me. He's about, I know, in his 30s. And he's telling me he's in a full-blown relationship with a 13-year-old girl, but it's part of his culture. This guy was Iraqi.
Yeah.
And the officer's saying to the call handler, I just want to check out with you whether that is religious, traditional, or is it part of his culture. And the call handler said, to quote, "Officer, if we can just remove the issues of culture, religion, tradition, and look at the possible raft of offences that could be happening to a 13-year-old girl." And he went, oh, if you put it like that then, and put the phone down. So, to me, you asked what success looks like. You know, why do professionals look the other way, and how can we prevent this? From my perspective, an inquiry really needs to ask that question, not to prosecute these people, but to think about how we can shift this, because this is still happening. So when I was at school, I'm one of seven sisters, all my sisters were taken out to British schools at the age of 15 to marry men in photographs in India.
Yes.
When I went missing, nobody asked where I was or my sisters. Nobody asked the question when we went missing. Why? Because it's what they do, it's cultural, and they look the other way. So I do think it is right and proper, whoever the leader is, and leadership matters, a leader is a dealer in hope, after all, that they've got to be fierce enough to go where we feel the victims are saying people are not going to go.
Okay, I understand most of that. Again, the response to earlier callers about why do we need an inquiry to establish what we already know?
Well, the point here is Louise Casey's review was very clear.
Yes.
That
they made 12 recommendations, actually.
Yeah.
This is only one of them.
Yeah, and the ethnicity of people involved in the grooming gangs was shied away from. So that is...
But we know that already.
No. But we don't know... And we do not understand why this is happening. This is still happening today, and I can tell you with conviction it happens in the space of child marriage, forced marriage. So what we need to get to the heart of, and this is not criminalising people, it needs to stop. And we need to ask the question and understand from the victim and survivor's experiences what their experiences were, but equally those professionals
see, this
who
is
look
the
other way.
This is the problem, because I like your analysis, and you obviously have a lot more experience of some of the issues that we're discussing than anybody else who's contributed to this conversation so far. But there will be other people who would shout you down. I don't, because you're essentially saying that the professionals need help in understanding why they should leave any cultural, ethnic or religious considerations at the door, focus entirely on the law of the land and the welfare of the victims, including, of course, 13-year-old girls who insist that they are in a full and frank relationship with a much older man, and that they want to be, and that they are not victims at all, which is part of the problem of policing some of these issues.
Well, that's grooming.
But yes, of course it is. It's a result, a success grooming. But there will be people shouting at you now saying they don't need help, they need locking up these professionals.
I have no issue.
Which means that the end of the inquiry will not satisfy them.
No, I have no issue with people shouting me down. That's the first thing.
No, of course not. Of course, but I'm trying to establish what almost a consensus on what success would look like might look like.
So we can identify those who are culpable, those people who were party to looking the other way, and they have to be dealt with. Absolutely, I agree with that point.
But dealt with how? Because they haven't committed any crimes.
Well, this is for the inquiry to identify the recommendations for it, is it not? But the point is, we're not going to understand without understanding why they felt that. A culture enables that. When one of my sisters committed suicide...
I'm so sorry.
Because she was the one taken out of education at the age of 15 to marry a stranger. When she came back to school as a married young girl, she looked different, she dressed different, she had a wedding ring on her finger. No teacher asked the question about where have you been for almost a year. Now, I'm not suggesting those teachers should be locked up. What I'm trying to get to the heart of is we need to understand why that culture exists, and in our society to root it out, to develop recommendations, and if it means law, okay, to say if you do this, that you will be suspended, investigated, removed from your role of a position of trust.
I mean, we've got that. Well, they've attempted to bring in something like that with the mandatory reporting legislation, which in my slightly well-informed opinion is not adequate legislation and doesn't do the things that they said it would do. But that they have already tried to do what you've described, absent this current inquiry.
Well, the mandatory
reporting. If your sister comes back to school and she is not yet 16 and she is telling people that she has got married, then that's a mandatory reporting issue. And any teacher who doesn't report that is then in professional and possibly legal jeopardy.
Well, Well, I have to say the mandatory reporting is not strong enough.
No, I agree with you on that, but you're telling me what the written aims of this inquiry are. We're not really any closer to understanding what success would look like.
Well, then maybe the things like the mandatory reporting, you look at that, you look at strengthening that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, that would be interesting, but we can do that without an inquiry, can't we?
Well, no, because ultimately what an inquiry will do is it will enable us to hear what the victims and the survivors are saying. It will be informed by them. For me, it has to start there.
And we had that with Alexis J. And you know better than I do how many of her recommendations have been. I mean, the boys I was at school with gave evidence to that inquiry, and 2 out of 20 of her recommendations have been enacted. So that's not a reason not to have more faith in this inquiry, but it's not exactly a vote of confidence in the process, is it?
Survivors are asking for that. The survivors are asking for this. Yes. So that matters to me.
Yes, but what would they say success looked like? They would say the people that look the other way need to be... I mean, the best we can do is name and shame them, and then you very sensibly and I think very powerfully suggest that might help provide a template to ensure it doesn't happen again, because some of these mistakes would have been made in good faith, but the people baying for the blood of the ones that, quotes, covered it up, end quotes, or, quotes, looked the other way, end quotes, or were far too hypersensitive about cultural considerations to be able to see the wood for the trees, like the police officer you began this call by telling us about on the phone to your own hotline. They're never going to agree with each other about what success would look like.
James, you and I both know, you know, not everybody's ever going to agree.
I know.
But you go with the consensus of common sense and what is the right and moral thing to do.
Yeah, I'm all for common sense and the right and moral thing to do, but in terms of, you know, things you could write down, I still don't think we're any closer to knowing exactly what that is, except, of course, to identify very specific instances of public sector workers, whether in the police, the social services or elsewhere, doing what you just described that police officer as doing. But even if we do that, it will be, you know, some individual cases, some satisfaction for individual victims, but would it be institutional? Would you be able to put in place, as a consequence of an inquiry, anything that you wouldn't be able to put in place now? For example, much more robust mandatory reporting legislation, which a lot of the people working in that field, like you, are not happy with, even though the government would probably claim they've gone further than any other government. It's not a pessimistic conversation, this, and your contribution has been brilliant, but it's still not an open and shut case that we know what the inquiry, what success would look like. And because one person's success will be somebody else's failure. And I think the best way of putting it is by saying, well, it will enable us to help public sector workers not make these mistakes again. And other people on the same room, in the same room, looking at the same facts and part of the same conversation, would be calling for those people who failed in their duties to be castigated in the strongest of terms. Do we want to help them or do we want to lynch them? It's 10:46.
This is LBC.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family. Get there safely. Do your trip checks. T. Stop up on island fuel. R. Rest every 2 hours too. I. Inspect tire pressure and tread. P. Prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. Safe trip begins with
Think. Do the 4-trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
ITV presents.
Oh my God.
Gas!
There is a chemical weapon in the cab.
We are dealing with a serial killer.
The devices are designed to kill, but first he wants to suffocate them. I'm spent.
I can't watch you. You give everything until you've got nothing left.
I take risks. That's my job.
Come out! Lana!
Hold your breath.
Trigger Point returns October 26 on ITV1 and ITVX.
When's the perfect moment to take that leap? With electric vehicles, that moment is now. The all-electric Leap Motor T03. Right now, with the Leap Grant, it's incredible value at 169 deposit and 169 per month with 0% APR, with amazing tech and spec too. Leap Motor, it's time to leap. Search Leap Motor T03. Personal contract purchase, Mint Green, T03, 48 months. Optional final payment, 5675. Leap Motor is credit broker, not in lender. Subject to status, T&Cs, throughout as financial services.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe. Only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
James O'Brien on LBC.
10:49 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. A couple of messages. It's probably too sensitive a subject for Idiot's Corner, but a couple of messages highlight the problem that Jim Gamble has acknowledged, that the toxicity of this. People who don't have any particular interest in the welfare of the victims or any particular answer to the question of what we want this inquiry to achieve. They just see it as an opportunity to indulge in well-established prejudices and bigotries. Simon's been in touch to say, one thing for sure... I'll read it verbatim. One thing I'd for sure, if you had anything to do with it, O'Brien, it would be a total waste of time. Thank goodness they won't be asking you. I've never seen such a compassionate expression of sympathy for the victims of child sexual abuse than that, Simon. I salute your integrity and your kindness. And this is from Kyle. Is James being thick? How about being able to talk about an issue without being called racist, which is why the grooming gangs got away with it so long? I've been talking about it since 2011, mate. No one's ever called me racist. Why is that, do you think? I've been talking about it very, very specifically, doing phone-ins about men from a specific region of Pakistan being disproportionately represented in this criminal category and saying the thing that baffled me most at the time was how you would dare to tell a friend or a family member or a colleague what you were doing, inviting them to join in. It's my experience of child sexual abuse through both of the schools that I went to was furtive and hidden and solitary, and the men that did it would be mortified if anybody had found out what they were doing and they'd have been jailed. So I remember doing the phone-ins on how can these men... What is the cultural context? What is the background? What is the history, the shared history, the shared experiences that meant that if I had groomed a 14-year-old girl into sexual activity with me, I would be confident that if I told you about it, then you would either want to join in or categorically not report me, consider me disgusting, or, let's be honest, kick my flipping face in. Which is what I suspect most of us would do if we found ourselves in the same situation. So Carl has a point. The claim that you can't talk about this without being called racist does underpin some of the toxicity and some of the rhetoric. But you need to tell me, Carl, how I have been able to talk about this since 2011 without being called racist by anybody. And it's not very hard to work out, because, of course, you know that I am equally disgusted by men who abuse children, regardless of who they are, where they're from, what they look like, or their history, culture, religion, or ethnicity. And if you are not equally disgusted, then you are racist. And that's the answer to the question. So you've got nothing to worry about, unless you think that a brown burglar is worse than a white burglar, unless you think that a brown paedophile is worse than a white paedophile. Then no one's going to call you racist. How do I know? Well, because I've been talking about it for longer than pretty much anybody. Actually, that's not fair. Colleagues on LBC, Nick has as well. Since Andrew Norfolk started breaking these stories, the late Andrew Norfolk started breaking these stories in the Times, we have been talking about it. And sometimes, some would argue too much. And I've never been called racist. Funny that, isn't it, mate? Neil's in Hartford. Neil, what would you like to say?
Hi there. I'm a survivor of sexual abuse. I was 11, 12, and abused by three men who were all connected, but within the church.
Right.
And I'm nearly 60 years old, and it still affects me every day. Trying to put my thought process in place, you may have to bear with me a second.
Of course.
This, to me, is much wider than the Pakistani grooming gangs. It's about the institutions that either control the regulation or control society. So for me, it's particularly the church. You know, there's still massive scandals going on in the church. But because of the institution and the reverence and the status they have in the country, they're not allowed to get away with it. But there's this, there's definitely evidence of kind of a constant cover-up or a nervousness to highlight the problem. And I think it's the same with the Pakistani grooming gangs. I think it's another form of almost institutionalism that's covering the problem. And I know what you're saying about, you know, what's the point in going back to people from 20, 30 years ago, you know, a lot of them may have even died by now.
Oh, no, I think there's a point. I think there's a point to it. I just don't know that it's a big enough point to satisfy some of the needs of the victims. Because once you've identified them and identified what they did wrong, it'll just go the way of the Alexis J inquiry and be ignored or forgotten.
Exactly. And the fact that governments haven't enacted, you know, 8 out of the 10 points in the Jay inquiry is down to those pathetic governments that we've had. You know, they should have looked at these and brought in legislation to try and...
Well, I do know, to be really cynical about it, it's also to do with the voters. I'm afraid we can't let ourselves off the hook on this. We might get very, very exercised in moments about allegations or about some cases. Post Jimmy Savile, the whole world seemed to care passionately about victims, and then 5 years later it didn't anymore. And the same with the church. You will know the segments of the Jay inquiry that looked very specifically at the Church of England, looked very specifically at schools like the one I attended, and the longer the inquiry went on, the more the level of public interest diminished.
I honestly think the best outcome for this is that it is slightly wider, that it's slightly, and I know that's probably not going to happen.
Well, it can't happen because
the Pakistani grooming gangs.
And also four victims have walked out of the inquiry because they felt that somebody was trying to make it wider simply by dint of asking if they wanted it to be wider. So that ain't going
to
happen.
I think the conclusions, though, James, need to be wider. That's what I'm saying. I think the conclusions and the outcome from the inquiry need to be wider, because I think this actually reflects on different sectors and different areas where people have been abused in different institutionalized situations, or institutions have either covered it up or been nervous to highlight it or been nervous to prosecute. And I think that's the bigger issue, where we've got organizations that still, I believe, are covering this up. Because of nervousness, and it may be nervousness because of their religion, because they're from the Church of England or they're from the Catholic Church or the Pakistani grooming gangs. It doesn't matter.
And there's institutional self-protection as well. Reputational protection kicks in, which is one of the most insidious things that you find in institutional context, where the top priority is to protect ourselves from outside criticism. Everybody does that, from schools to police forces to politicians. Thank you. I'm so sorry for what you went through, Neil, and I absolutely understand that it never leaves you. 10:57 is the time. Just to circle back to Jasvinda, who was with us a moment ago, and her charity, just in case you are affected by those issues. It's a specialist charity for victims and survivors that she set up herself, called Karma Nirvana, two words, looking at ending honour-based abuse in the UK. Jasvinda was, in fact, Dame Jasvinda Sangira, CBE, who, as she told us, escaped a forced marriage at 15, but tragically lost her own sister to honour-based abuse. If you're affected by any of those issues, you can find Karma Nirvana online, and the number you would need to contact them now on that helpline she told us about is 0800 599 247. That's 0800 599 247. Amber is in Battersea. Amber, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. I was thinking that in terms of what success looks like, how about some really, I mean, for this inquiry, some really in-depth research and analysis as to where are their commonalities as to how these people have become victims? What is their history? What is their lifestyle? How have they got to the point that these people have been able to take advantage of them? And then also to conduct the same level of research as to the perpetrators of these appalling crimes as well. Because then as a society, surely we ought to be able to correct those things.
It's not doing that. It's not designed to do that. The argument would be that has already been done. Some of the commonalities, and there's not going to be any that are universal, but these are often young girls that were in care or girls who were from dysfunctional backgrounds, girls that were very vulnerable as a consequence of their domestic situation. Not always, but very, very often. And the reason why the inquiry is specific to a certain type of offender is because we already know the commonality of the certain type of offender.
But surely the greatest success then, as far as the victims today are concerned, is that we prevent future victims from becoming.
And we're back where we started in a way, because you don't need an inquiry to do that. You need to start enacting the recommendations from the last one. Which is where Keir Starmer was at the beginning of the year, but the intervention of Claire Casey and his charge to Claire Casey was resulted in this inquiry being called, and you want it, you want it to achieve something, but it's really important to keep asking people what they want it to achieve, and if they can't tell you, then it's just possible that that's why it is currently caught up in chaos and even toxicity, because. Calling an inquiry without a really clear remit or a really clear definition of what success would look like, and that's why it's a good thing that he's bringing Louise Casey back into the fold, leads to, arguably, the sort of confusion and even some of the toxicity that we're seeing now. So it could be that the question we've been trying to answer for the last hour is actually the answer. To the question. It is the absence of a neat definition of what success would look like that explains why it is currently caught up in so much confusion and toxicity. Occam's razor suggests that that's why, because none of us have been able to come up with a better reason. It's 11 o'clock.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, ministers have insisted Jess Phillips has the backing of Sir Keir Starmer after she faced calls to resign. Four abuse survivors say they'd only consider returning to the grooming gang inquiry if the safeguarding minister steps down. The two candidates to lead the inquiry have also pulled out of the process. One of them, the former senior police officer Jim Gamble, has told LBC it has turned into petty politicking.
We've reached a point where... We are echoing mistakes of the past. We're not putting victims and survivors at the centre. And I'm saying that across the board. So this isn't simply about me, you know, targeting one set of politicians. No one has covered themselves in glory in this.
The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says a ceasefire with Russia is still possible. He is attending a summit in Brussels after the US and EU imposed new sanctions on Russia's energy sector. The White House says it's a result of Moscow's lack of serious commitment to a peace process to end the war in Ukraine. A minister has insisted the government will keep sending migrants back to France again and again. It's after an Iranian man deported under the one-in, one-out deal, returns deal, came back to Britain on a small boat. The Children's Minister, Josh McAllister, has told LBC it shows the scheme is working.
If there is no realistic prospect of you being able to cross and stay, people won't pay gangs. And that is why we're trying to test this pilot, scale it up. We're doing it as quickly as we can. It's not the only solution. We're taking lots of other action as well. But the message from this guy crossing again is, if you cross again, you will be returned again. And he can cross again and he will be returned again. He won't be staying here.
The King and Queen are meeting Pope Leo at the Vatican at the start of their state visit. They are due to pray together in a display of unity between the Catholic Church and the Church of England. It's a first for a British monarch and pontiff since the Reformation. And the Met Office has scaled back its weather warnings for Storm Benjamin. The yellow alerts for wind and rain now cover a smaller area of the east and southeast of England until this afternoon. Forecasters say there could still be some travel disruption and flooding. In the city, the FTSE 100 time ago was trading at 95.51. That's up 36. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 15. LBC weather, heavy rain and strong winds affecting many parts of England and Wales, but drier in the north and west, a high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Tesco Finest, Alderwood Smoked Bacon. the foundation for the ultimate bacon butty. It's why only the finest bacon is traditionally hand-cured with Cornish sea salt, delicately smoked over alderwood, and matured for at least 19 days. Layer it between slices of crusty bread and savour its richer flavour. All you have to think about is brown sauce or red. Make your everyday taste better with Tesco Finest. Majority of larger stores.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
At 11:04 is the time. Education next. We turn our attention to another story that is a bit of a double-take territory. One in 12 pupils in isolation at least weekly. This is secondary pupils reporting being put into school isolation rooms at least once a week. In some cases, spending in excess of 8 hours, missing more than a full day of lessons. Children with special educational needs were more than twice as likely to be placed in isolation, otherwise known as internal exclusion. And some other demographics are quite upsetting as well. If you're on free school meals, you're more than 1.5 times more likely to be placed in isolation than a wealthier pupil, a wealthier peer. It's research from the University of Manchester. Children who identify as LGBTQ plus, twice as likely. Black, Asian and mixed heritage children also measurably more likely to be placed in isolation than white British peers. I mean, the first question I've got, and I sometimes ask these questions and then so many people are queuing up to answer that we can't get to the next bit, but I want to know what an isolation booth is. I can probably work it out, but it sounds pretty brutal, doesn't it? An isolation booth. I've realised in recent years that people like me are part of the problem when it comes to conversations like this. And I wish I hadn't been. I really do. But I got into quite a lot of trouble at school, and I used to think that was relevant to this conversation, because the people that I got into trouble with were adamant that it was all my fault. And I believed them. Until very recently, I believed them. Probably until becoming a parent, actually. And even long after that, I still believed them. The reason why I got into a lot of trouble when I was at school was all my fault. And it's so counterintuitive as well, because a couple of the lads who got into even more trouble than I did were the victims of the paedophiles that I was telling you about in the last hour. And that's why they were, for want of a better phrase, playing up or misbehaving, because they were being tortured, torturing themselves internally and being abused by men they were supposed to be able to trust on school grounds. And remember, I went to boarding school. There was never any escape. These poor boys. It wasn't their fault that they got into trouble. There was a boy who got beaten more than I did. And he was, we discovered many years later, one of the victims of a paedophile teacher at my school. So because he was in turmoil and in torture, this isn't a special educational needs angle, we'll get on to that. But it's proof that it wasn't his fault that he was, quote, naughty, end quote. Someone's turning up at the headmaster's study's door once a week to be beaten. You'd sort of think one of two things, right? Well, this isn't working as a deterrent or as a form of discipline, because it's the same boys every week. It's bloody O'Brien again. And the second thing you'd think is maybe there's something else going on here. And that's where special educational needs come in. Maybe there's something else going on here. If it's the same children getting into trouble repeatedly, maybe there's something else going on here. You know, if you were listening yesterday, and it's something I've mentioned a lot recently, but the big lesson I've taken away from therapy is to look after little me, to look after that boy who was standing outside that room waiting to be beaten brutally by a 6'3" man with a specially designed weapon for beating him. But I think in some ways isolation can be traumatic as well. You're shutting children up and marking them as naughty. Now, this is not to deny the existence of naughtiness. Of course it's not. But it is to question the likelihood of all of these children disproportionately represented in isolation rooms or isolation booths as having special educational needs. Does that make them more likely to be naughty, or is there something else going on? Is there something more complicated going on? I think I'd like this conversation to be conducted from the point of view of people who used to be children, who got into a lot of trouble. It may be that we turn to parents of children who are in special educational needs territory, or who are being punished a lot for things that you don't think they can control. You know, the question we discovered about, was it 6 months ago? I love it when that happens. I go all Kevin Keegan. I love it when that happens. When we actually find a way into territory that we've explored quite a lot together before with a really interesting new dimension. And the crucial question here is the difference between can't and won't. We did it on what they still insist on calling school refusal. And laws brought in to punish parents whose children are not going to school. And the question really of what is the difference between a child who won't go to school through willfulness or rebellion, naughtiness or mood, and a child who can't go to school because of crippling anxiety, appalling mental health. Things that are only relatively recently being properly recognised and acknowledged. I don't know if you've seen, or Jules has seen it, I don't know if you've seen I Swear yet, an incredible film about a boy growing up with Tourette's syndrome. He got beaten for his Tourette's. Kind of puts my experiences in the shade a bit. So if you needed the most perfect distillation of punishing somebody for something they can't control, John McDonald is your man. Beaten for his Tourette's. So his tics, tics sometimes involve profane outbursts, swear words. You know how Tourette's syndrome works. And he would then get beaten for it by the headmaster at his school. That is the most perfect exemplar of punishing children for things they have no control over. I'll never come up with a better one, actually. And I think of that when I read a story like this. One in 12 secondary pupils report being put into school isolation rooms at least once a week. And I think of little me. And the times I got into trouble. And immediately, within moments, the big one actually was not being beaten. It would be being sent out of the class. And you... Can I put this? I think you either know what I'm talking about because I'm talking about you as well as me, or you've got no idea what I'm talking about because you thought we were all naughty. And the minute he says get out, you've made your friend laugh, you've done something, you've possibly had one warning, and you can't heed it, you can't process it. It's so mad to try to explain this. And listen, if I've got any neurodiversities or anything like that, I'm very much in the foothills of these things. And without wanting to be an idiot about it, I was clever enough to cover a lot of it up, because even if I'd been chucked out of class, I could still come in, do the exam and do well. But if I hadn't had that, if I'd had dyslexia as well as discipline, God knows where I'd have ended up. But it's this, I remember a science teacher who I really liked, and I kept getting sent out of his class. And the minute I'm outside that classroom, I'm engulfed in shame. It was bad enough that it was a Catholic school where shame was on the curriculum. But I'm literally engulfed. I'm thick with shame because I really liked that teacher and I really wanted to do well. And I'd promised him, I'd promised me, I'd promised Mum I wasn't going to get into trouble again. I was constantly on report cards. I had to go up to the teacher at the end of the class and have your behaviour rated because I was disruptive, or I would be fidgeting, or I would be interrupting or making jokes. I didn't want to be that boy. I've only realised this in the last year because of these conversations. Hearing people like I used to be say, well, I was very naughty when I was young, and never quite, I hope, being a complete prat and suggesting that there's no such thing as ADHD, or that there's no such thing as oppositional defiance disorder, or whatever, thankfully, we've now given names to. Well, I was just naughty in my day. I don't know what these kids... I don't think I was, wasn't I? I was that idiot. Long time ago, long before you started listening. 1.4 million again on the rate chart. Do you know, I don't think it was even 0.4 when I started. But I never wanted to be that boy. It's so weird. And then you sort of persuade yourself somehow that it's cool. It becomes part of your identity. You're the naughty boy. I used to boast about being the second most beaten boy in the history of the school. Remember, I would do that before I knew that the most beaten boy in the history of the school was being sexually abused by a paedophile. The idea that you have agency, that a child who keeps getting into trouble is waking up in the morning and saying to himself, do you know what I'm going to do today? I'm going to get into even more trouble than I got into yesterday. Those children sitting in those isolation rooms are thick with the shame that I felt. And they are telling themselves they're never going to come back into it again. And then the next day, something happens, and I don't know what it is. Something happens, and you're in it again. I've done it again. Oh, I've done it again. Now, oddly, if it's Tourette's, this is really, really easy to understand. Now, it wasn't when John McDonald was at school and he was being beaten for his tics. But if it's not, if it's a more invisible neurodiversity, if you're spending more than 8 hours a week in a room doing nothing except twiddling your thumbs or whatever the modern equivalent of lines is, oh, you're not choosing to do this. And you're making everything worse by isolating them. So, what on earth is the question? Well, the most obvious question is, do you want to have a go at describing what I have failed to describe? Not wanting to be naughty, but always getting into trouble. Because that was you as well. 0345-6060973. Have a crack at it. Does anyone want to tell me whether or not isolation serves any useful purpose whatsoever? Teachers, perhalfs. Many of you are on half term. 0345-6060973. But I want to help, because I honestly think you're either like me or you've got no idea what I'm talking about. And it's only relatively recently I've stopped thinking it was cool to be in trouble all the time. So remember also not being able to work. I met even as I got older, and I'd be under quite serious threat of sanction if you don't catch up on some of the essays that you haven't written. And other lads, everyone else would just be working. They'd just be sitting there writing and working and getting their work done. And I'd be sitting there. I can't even remember what I would do, but there was something. I just felt so heavy. I got it so heavy. And I could almost watch the clock tick into terrible time. Click into trouble. Oh, I'm in trouble now. I couldn't do anything about it. It's like an anxiety dream. I would have been in an isolation booth more than 8 hours a week. I'd have been in there all the flipping time. And remember, I was at an expensive private school where they kind of couldn't get away with just filing you away and forgetting about you. You can't explain the difference between I can't do it and I won't do it. I can't explain the difference between I hate that teacher and I'm going to get him and, oh my God, I'm in trouble again. How have I ended up in trouble again? It's extraordinary. Okay, so, why? And this is something parents, teachers, and former children can answer. Why do special educational needs pupils end up being punished more than everybody else? 0345-6060973. And how likely is it that it's their fault? Because I hope now, at 17 minutes after 11, after that personal but quite well-informed introduction, you're thinking, well, of course it's not their fault. How could I ever have thought that it was? Why are we still treating these children as if they wake up in the morning and say to themselves, I'm going to cause trouble? So Victorian, isn't it? That sort of children are the bane of our existence. I just spare the rod and spoil the child. All that kind of nonsense. Beat them into submission. Storing up lifetimes of problems and repression. Children with special educational needs are twice as likely to be punished. In this context, in the 21st century, in 2025... to be placed in isolation. But I bet you £1 million that you go back 30 or 40 years and children with special educational needs, brackets, although they hadn't been identified or diagnosed at that stage in British history, were more than twice as likely to be beaten. Were more than twice as likely to be battered. Were more than twice as likely to be dragged out of the classroom by their ear, screaming and crying, please, sir, stop. Children with special educational needs were more than twice as likely to be hurt, to be abused, to be beaten, and today to be placed in isolation. Do you want to have a go at explaining why that is? I've tried. 0345 6060 973. Do you want to have a go at explaining why that is? Because it was you. Or because it's your boy or your little girl. And you don't have the same issues, which means you can watch with a sort of dispassionate detachment. But just think about those words. Next time you hear someone giving it the, oh, I was naughty. 1 in 12 secondary pupils report being put into school isolation rooms at least once a week. Children with special educational needs were more than twice as likely to be placed in isolation. Just tell us why. Because I tell you why it isn't. It's not because they wake up every morning determined to cause trouble, become demonised and get punished. Hit the numbers now, you will get through.
LBC.
Play Set for Life from the National Lottery. Winners get 10k every month for 30 years. You could win on repeat. Set for Life. Play now on the National Lottery app. Terms, rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest. You probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Amazon has increased funding for employees to £3,000 a year every year for career development. Like Juliet, she's now a trained technician. And to her, the sound of machinery in need of repair reminds her of how far she's come. In 2 years, she's landed her dream job, providing her with valuable skills. That's up to £3,000 every year for career development at Amazon. Eligibility conditions apply.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
I don't know where that came from. I have absolutely no idea where that came from. Isn't that strange? Just thinking about being punished and thinking about these children being punished and realising that they, like me, did not have much control over what it was they did that got them punished. And how can that be still so absent from education discourse? It beats me. James is in Scarborough. James, what made you pick up the phone?
Hello, James. Lovely to talk to you again. I'll give you a perfect example of kind of the bitter irony where I would be trying to concentrate because I didn't want to get in trouble because I was always in trouble.
Yeah.
And there was no other child who was trying the hardest to concentrate in that classroom, I can guarantee it. Yeah. But who was the one getting told off for not concentrating? It was me every single class. I remember going out, this is a funny story, I remember going outside the headmaster's office and he opened the door and he saw me stood there and he screamed at me for 5 minutes. And then he said, and why are you here now? And I said, I've come for a merit stamp, sir. So that's kind of the level of demonisation that we face. And I think part of the issue is I've got a friend and she complains that her Down syndrome child walks in a room and everyone treats them like a Down syndrome child.
Yeah.
But when you've got more kind of hidden neurodiversity, sometimes your IQ's, you know, through the roof compared to the other students. There's a higher expectation placed upon you, but that ignores the other things that are kind of going on underneath. And our attempts, the school system isn't made for us, and we're trying to fit within that and getting penalised for not fitting within that.
Can we have a crack? Because I failed. You might be able to do a better job than me. Of explaining to somebody who doesn't know what you're talking about why you couldn't concentrate more.
Well, it's a bit of a misdemeanour as well, because we can concentrate on the things we're interested in. In fact, we hyper-focus. But
yeah, no, but I'm talking about the moments when you couldn't. So you're in class. Concentrate, 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 concentrate. Mm. Oh, Lord, I've just thrown a paper aeroplane across the room. It ambushes you, doesn't it? I think that the Tourette's analogy is actually quite helpful, because it is as if you can't help it.
It is, absolutely. But I think when we can as well, it puts a higher expectation on us, because then it seems like it's a choice and it isn't.
No.
And it's like, I used to describe it when you're younger in particular, it's like a spring that's compressed and you are trying to, but eventually that's just going to boing, and the impulse is there. You lose the concentration. And if you are concentrating on something that isn't giving you enough dopamine and a bird flies past the window, you turn to that. And and we were always in the trouble as well, because someone would whisper something and you just go, what? And you'd be the one talking because everyone else knows to keep quiet. But it is like Tourette's, of that impulse. You know, obviously ADHD and Tourette's are very closely linked anyway.
So
it's those kind of impulses that just get you, that you have no... No, my daughter as well got in trouble recently where the teacher said something, she went, shut up. But immediately she went, oh, what have I just said?
Yeah.
So it's that subconscious becomes a conscious.
Do you know, as an adult, or at least what passes for an adult, I identify as an adult, James, I don't know if I qualify, but some of the stuff that I did, I can't believe the teachers thought that I meant it. There was one time I remember where there was this cable on the wall. And we used to climb around the wall, halfway up the wall with footholds and stuff like that. An old Victorian wall, but there was a big old cable on the corner that you used to hold so you could swing round and carry on. And the headmaster announced at lunch one day that we were no longer allowed to touch that cable because it was coming away from the bracketing, and I don't know, the whole school would have burnt down. And I went out of lunch, I went downstairs, and I climbed the thing and I went round the corner and I held it. And I got caught, and I got sent to be beaten. And how could anyone have thought that that was conscious decision or deliberate? I mean, it was such a stupid thing to do that I think if I witnessed, I don't know, would I? If I witnessed somebody doing it, would I perhaps say, why are you John Davidson, his name was in the film, forgive me, not John McDonald. John Davidson. I did say, that's the bit, isn't it? Adults are just too busy. And so the easy thing to do is to send you to an isolation room, and that's why they do it all the time.
I think so. I was the guy, I don't even remember, who said that you probably have ADHD.
I remember you saying that. And that's why I've got sympathy for these children, because you've got an education like mine, and the amount of money that was spent on me, I'm going to get all the breaks that are available. And that's why... These children more likely to be put into isolation. It's not just the neurodiversity; it's also the diverse backgrounds, the different backgrounds. What I mean? Can we? Go on.
Sorry, I think as well we've got more understanding, but education's also changed. So when I see children now, why things haven't improved is we. As a kid, even with the issues, for me, they'd say, and I'm in my mid-40s, they'd say, James, go and stand outside for 5 minutes and calm down and come back in. So I wouldn't get as penalised, whereas now there's very rigid, particularly with academies, protocols of how you treat behaviour. So now they would have said, right, James, your name's on the board, calm down. And I would object to that because I'd be trying to concentrate. I probably would have even said, I am concentrating. Then I'd be told off for being cheeky. Then all those protocols have gone through, and then I'm kicked out of class. So we've got more understanding and yet a more authoritarian, rigid system within our education system.
And that surprises me, actually, because I would have thought things had mellowed. And of course, that's the tabloid narrative, isn't it, that everybody gets it easy these days. I don't know what an isolation booth is. I can probably work it out, but...
sensory deprivation. Well,
it sounds like torture.
Yeah, I couldn't do it as an adult if you paid me for a day. Even if you offered me a lot of money, I could not do it.
Because you'd go nuts. You'd be climbing the walls, literally. And that's, I mean, that is such an odd thing to do to a child. If it happened to you, give me a call. There's one phone line free. You've got to be quick and grab the one that James is just vacating. Thank you, James. Stuart's in Yeovil. Stuart, what made you pick up the phone?
Good morning, James. Come I can't believe I'm through to you straight away. Right, first of all, I was that boy at school. Right, I'm 60 now, and I was that boy at school because I was undiagnosed with dyslexia and ADHD.
Yeah.
And my school in Bath at the time was single sex. Was it just a state school? But I always remember in English, I had to read, we were reading Hemingway, The Old Man and the Sea. I don't know if you ever read that book.
Yeah, beautiful book.
Absolutely can't stand it. Hate the thing with a passion because of the way my English teacher made me feel.
I'm sorry.
And I had to stand up and try to read it, and I started stuttering. Of course, I was called stupid and made to stand in the corner.
Mm.
We were talking 1982. So I now fast forward. I joined the army, been very successful. Then I become a teacher, and I'm a special needs teacher, and I work with these children. And I understand fully why these kids get into trouble. I understand how and why they get into trouble. And I think some of the, and what you just said about the isolation booze is unfair, what you're saying about the schools. Just let me explain. So you've got two choices when you're a kid like myself with ADHD or dyslexia. You either admit you can't do it, and then you stand the ridicule of your peers or friends and ribbing, which as a 15-year-old boy doesn't go down too well, okay?
For sure.
Or you think, I will act the goat, and then I will get sent out, because then I haven't failed, I haven't done it. And I become then the class clown, and I get a reputation, and I can thrive off that reputation. But if you've got a good school, and what we used to set up, and I worked in a, you know, I set my own SEN base up, and we called it the base, and it was their safe haven. Now, if you've got, and the difference is educating the teachers to try and do it. I know what that your previous caller was just saying about name on the board and things like that. What I've always taught the teachers, and it works a lot, you know, you'll just give them a little nod. There's one. You know, and you try to keep them on track. You're trying to help them. Maybe sometimes sending them out for a couple, just take 2 minutes outside. Then when you come back in, you'll be fine and we settle down. Sometimes that works and sometimes that helps them. The isolation should never be for some student that suffers with and has been diagnosed with neurodiversity, dyslexia, ADHD, dyscalculia, any of that. You know, they should be sent then to us because the teacher has run out of options.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I hate to say it, but you do have to look at it. I've been a teacher and I've been stood there in front of 34 kids, you know, teaching them history. I used to have a passion for history. If I've got 30 of them...
No. I absolutely understand why teachers are left with little or no choice in these kind of scenarios, because isolating one child or having a classroom of 40 children disrupted is a no-brainer.
Yeah, of course, and you have to. But then you've got to make sure that the schools have a base. We, and another school I worked at in Dubai, I called it the bridge, because it was the bridge.
But most schools don't. Most schools don't.
They do, James. They do. There is always, in a secondary school, there is an SEN department. It depends on the academy or the funding of the school, how good that department
is. Well, then why are so many children being put into isolation, then?
Because that's what I'm just about to say. Because if there's one poor SEN teacher and two LSAs, you know, what can we do? The school I just left at, you know, because I'm so disillusioned with the system, I just retired.
Well, that's what I just said.
Became a president. You know, I'm agreeing. Yeah. We had, I had 900 kids on roll because it was a through school from secondary to, primary to secondary. I had over 300 on the SEN register. I had seven LSAs and me.
Yeah.
It's just impossible.
And it would be to every, it would be to everybody. I'm late for the news, mate. That's the only reason I'm cracking on. It would be impossible to address that without proper funding and proper support, but it would be better for everybody. So what these isolation rooms seem to do is they're like fridges. You're just putting someone in a fridge so that everybody else can get on with everything. No thought for the person in the fridge, really. No benefit to them from it. Just get them out of this. And that adds to the shame. That adds to the isolation. And of course, some kids are choosing to do that because the alternative is to say, I'm sorry, I can't read this. I'm sorry, I can't do this. I'm sorry, I don't understand that. Again, you know, I wonder how much of the consequences of what we're discussing are themselves consequences of austerity. Thomas Watts is here with the headlines.
Ministers have rallied behind Jess Phillips after she faced calls to resign over the grooming gang inquiry. Four abuse survivors say they would only consider returning to an oversight panel if the safeguarding minister steps down. The Environment Agency has recorded England's water company's worst environmental performance on record. Thames Water, which is beset by financial problems, was alone in scoring the worst rating of just one of four stars. The King and Queen are attending a service in the Sistine Chapel on their state visit to the Vatican. Monarch and Pontiff are praying together in the first such display of unity since the Reformation. LBC weather, heavy rain and strong winds for many parts of England and Wales, drier in northern and western areas, a high of 13 degrees.
This is LBC.
Private healthcare sounds pricey.
At Benenden Health, it's less than £16 per person per month.
Just for GP calls.
For a 24/7 GP helpline, physio, diagnostics and more. Now, tell me.
All about my medical history.
No, no medical questionnaires or hidden charges. We like to call it
healthcare done different.
Spot on. Benenden Health. Healthcare done different. Fee review periodically. 6-month wait for some services. T&Cs apply. Selected surgical procedures after 6 months. 24 in Northern Ireland. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe, only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
Sharing intimate photos of her without her consent.
Unwanted touching. Unwanted comments. Unwanted nudes.
Controlling what she can and can't wear.
Controlling who she can and can't see.
Threatening her.
Enough. This is abuse.
If you think it's wrong, act on it.
Call it out, show support, report it.
There are many ways you can safely tackle violence against women and girls. Find out how at gov.uk/enough. If someone is in danger, call 999.
Step aboard the legend of the Titanic, London's award-winning exhibition devoted to the world's most famous ocean liner at Dock X Canada Water. Walk her decks, explore her cabins, discover her secrets. With 360-degree projections, VR, an interactive metaverse, artifacts and more. Book your tickets today at legendoftitanic.com.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
It is 25 minutes to 12. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC, where the curious case, really, of 1 in 12 pupils being put into isolation at least weekly, and the appalling overrepresentation of children with special educational needs, and the sort of realisation, somewhat belatedly, that, well, A, that probably would have been me, and B, it happens for two reasons. It happens because give a teacher a choice between having a disrupted class of 40 children or removing the disruptor for the foreseeable, then every teacher under the sun, if that's the choice they feel they face, if the third option of defusing the situation or de-escalating the disruption is not an option, you've tried and failed all of the tactics and tricks in that book, then of course you're going to put the child into isolation. But what of the child? And there you come to this extraordinary moment, which I haven't really addressed before or even clocked, when you acknowledge that it's a bit like talking about children not going to school. Most of them can't. It's not won't. And just because we could somehow persuades us that they're all swinging the lead or taking the mickey. So these children who are being sent into isolation 8 hours a week, all the time, potentially every day, are often not able to help themselves. More often than not, not able to help themselves, which makes it absolutely crystal clear that it is the neurodiversity or the special educational need that is informing their behaviour, not naughtiness or rebelliousness or mischievousness or any of those things. So what the hell is the point of isolation? Answer, from their point of view, absolutely nothing. It makes everything worse. But for the other 39 kids in the class, it's the best case scenario. What an absolute pudding. Hugh's in Pontypool. Hugh, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Hello. How are we doing?
Very well, mate. What's on your mind?
So I was a teacher for 22 years. I left this summer. So it's my first September in a very long time.
Gosh.
And October without being there. And I taught my entire career in the same school. I was also the ALNCO, the Additional Learning Needs Coordinator.
Okay.
And I ran, on a temporary basis, the specialist resource base for children with autism. But before I finished, I was ahead a year. And the school runs what would be known as an internal exclusion room, which essentially is an, isolation.
Yeah.
And it's quite a, I think your last, I think it was a Stuart, the last caller was, he hit on a number of things. But it's quite a complex issue in that, one, by the time a number of children who get to secondary school haven't been diagnosed, in terms of their learning, they're so far behind.
It is
trying to get them diagnosed, trying to get the right support can take anywhere from 2 to 3 years, and in some cases it's been 4 years. Also, you have schools now that are so rigid in their thinking in order to sort of appease Ofsted in Wales.
Is it?
And in England, there is very, you know, lessons now are so heavily structured that, you know, if you think that, you know, just to, not to bore everybody with the structure of a lesson, if you think that a lesson, you know, what an inspector would be looking for when they walk into the room, they would want to be seeing a start, a do-no activity, so something to get them engaged immediately, a starter, a main part of your lesson, an activity within that, and then a plenary, all in the space of about 50 minutes, and you've got 30 children, but in your class you may have 2 or 3 individuals there, sometimes more, with a myriad of...
So just get them out.
Additionally, there isn't that time.
No, just get them out.
And so they have to, you know, and you are... I would always try my very, very best. Sure. And very rarely would I send anybody out of the room.
Sure.
Very rarely. But then I would be penalised for that.
Got it.
Which then, so you think, actually, I knew I had to get out of teaching when the three-piece suits started showing up in the schools.
Mm.
You know, realistically, if you're wearing a three-piece suit, swanning around your school, you're not really getting stuck in there because you haven't got time to do anything. You know, you were there, you were lucky to have a pee at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You know, and the exclusion rooms, you are seeing the same characters over and over again in there. But lots of that is because by the time that they've got to secondary school, their behaviours are so ingrained, their needs are so entrenched, it's very, very difficult then to try and sort of work with that.
I get it. I don't know where that phrase came from earlier, feeling thick with shame, is that they might put on brave faces and come across as, you know, the Fonzarellis of their generation or whatever it is, but nobody really wants to be that kid.
No, absolutely not. And, you know, the number of times that, you know, being ahead of you, one of the things that you end up doing, you would be on what we would call call. Mm. So you'd have a radio, and a member of staff, if there was an issue with a pupil and they needed to leave, you would be called, and then you would have to collect that pupil, and then they would be parked in IE for the rest of that lesson. And then that member of staff then would have to arrange a restorative meeting with that pupil. And if they didn't, you know, and then hopefully they could work it out. But then if the pupil missed that restorative lesson, they went straight back. It's an ever-ending circle.
Over the course of the 22 years, how much of it was exacerbated by things like funding cuts and teaching assistants? So we sit here today articulating a problem. How much of it has been made worse by politicians? And you can say none. I'm not fishing here. You can tell me none, actually. It's all different factors.
100%. 100%. Because you're we're getting... People say, about everybody seems to have ADHD these days. Well, actually, what we are getting much better at is assessing, understanding, diagnosing, supporting. But we're getting better at those things, but there's less and less money to be able to put in support that works. So what you end up with, and, you know, teaching assistants, with a really, really good teaching assistant or an LSA within your classroom is worth their weight in gold, because they will, more often than not, work with those one, you know, even though they're supposed to be there with that one individual, they will then work with others as well. And that goes down to teacher planning, but then it's about time to be able to do that.
And it's the first thing to go when head teachers are having to shave their budgets.
100%. 100%.
It's usually there, isn't it? There's usually something there that leads back to political decisions or austerity, or, you know, if you want to be a little bit more objective or fair about it, just sort of shortage of investment, shortage of funds. And tomorrow we'll probably be having a conversation about how awful it would be if Rachel Reeves puts taxes up. Every conversation we have acknowledges the necessity of more public spending. not every conversation, I'm exaggerating, obviously, but then within the same breath, we'll be either hearing or possibly even articulating ourselves the idea that, oh, they actually put taxes up. Won't somebody think of the farmers? Thank you, Hugh. Leroy's in Ryslip. Oh, no, Ben's in Morecambe. Ben, what would you like to say?
Good morning, James. How are you doing?
I'm good.
Yeah, some good points coming across here recently. I say my son at the moment is a bit different. He's in primary school at the moment. My daughter, 15, she's obviously secondary school. We're just on the pathway for her for SEND needs.
Right.
My son has his diagnosis of autism. The issue we're finding is this: us as parents, we are currently going through the EACP renewal and starting the process for specialty schools.
Yeah,
for him.
I'm just conscious of the time, Ben. I'm going to nudge you towards
this on.
That's okay.
Issue we found in the local areas is all around EACP planning and getting these specialist schools for pupils, where the local authorities are pushing them, moving the pieces a bit and keeping the children with SEND needs in a mainstream school because there just isn't any funding.
So there are children who should be in specialist schools who are in mainstream schools, and they're disrupting the mainstream schools through no fault of their own, which is the sentence that is most obviously missing from these conversations, and then they end up being stuck in isolation for
because
hours.
Because the schools don't have the provisions.
And they've literally got no way of dealing with them properly. So every call really is adding a thread to the same tapestry, isn't it? It's, you know, whether we're bringing it back to funding within the school or whether we're bringing it back to funding without the school.
Yeah,
it's
I think we could
there.
Talk to the council on home about funding. I mean, I think over the last 14 years, there's been a massive decline in that. There has been an increase in funding in the areas, but when you actually look at the government's figures themselves, it's actually probably about around a 10% drop in funding per EHCP due to the amount of people that are obviously
The specialist facilities are thin on the ground as well. There's a terrible story.
For us, we're... the school we're at the moment, there's been two pupils there that have been waiting 2 and 3 years for a place.
And possibly even worse than that, a story in Private Eye this week about a facility in the Lake District that has been shut down. Literally, kids there, residential, being told, that's it, you're going to have their parents being told, you're going to have to find somewhere else by the beginning of next term. It's an extraordinary piece. It has links to Bono, of all people, of U2, but as ever, where Private Eye leads, hardly anybody else follows. It is 11:45. Thank you, Ben. I was conscious of the time. Not least because I've got a guest in the next segment, which doesn't happen terribly often on this programme, but occasionally the guest merits it. And this is the fellow who set up Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales. An extraordinary sort of introduction, that, really, isn't it? Of all the things that have become part of our collective furniture over the last few years, whether online or offline, few are going to have assumed quite as much space as Wikipedia. He's got a new book out, which we will also be finding out about. And after him, of course, it's Mystery Hour. So I sometimes find that when we don't take calls, or we don't take many calls in the final sector of the 11 o'clock hour, you a bit slow on the uptake at the top of the 12 o'clock hour. So if you've been if you're one of those incredibly boring people that sends me endless messages about how hard it is to get through on Mystery Hour, all of which involves using time to send me boring messages that could have been used trying to get through to Mystery Hour, then today might be one of the days when you have a slightly better than average chance of getting on the board. But all that is to come at 12 noon. The time now is 11:46.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
Why this staggering level of incompetence?
Straight to the point.
This is the economics of the madhouse from this government.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
But she does seem to struggle with her sums.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
I'm fulfilling more international orders thanks to working capital support.
Export insurance protects my business against the risk of not getting paid by an overseas buyer.
At UK Export Finance, we help businesses export with confidence. Between 2024 and 2025, we provided over £14 billion of government-backed finance and insurance to help businesses grow overseas. Search UK Export Finance to find out how we could help you win export contracts, fulfil orders, and get paid.
Why crawl when you can glide? Why stall when you can be dynamic, agile, like a dolphin? The BYD Dolphin Surf is the compact car for the city. Register by 31st of December and this super smart hatchback can be yours for just £199 a month with £199 deposit and 0% APR. Visit BYD.com. T's and C's apply. Finance provided by Santander Consumer Finance. 49-month agreement. Optional final payment £6,771.38.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Hi, I'm Piers Morgan. It's official. Woke is dead and I've written the obituary. Cancel celebs are emerging from social media jail and virtue signalling is punishable by ridicule. So what caused this shift? How did the silenced majority win? And what's next? In my new book, Woke is Dead, I explore the fall of woke culture and the return to a world of common sense over cancellation, seeking unity over division. You'll be shocked by how much you agree with me. Woke is Dead is out now.
At TfL, we're helping to make bus journeys greener. Our entire bus fleet is 100% low or zero emission at the tailpipe, including those for our Superloop routes, helping improve air quality for all. And we'll have a fully zero emission fleet by 2034. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
11:49 is the time. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I'm joined by Jimmy Wales, the co-founder of Wikipedia, which is, I read in my notes, viewed 11 billion times every month in the English language alone. Can I be the millionth person to ask you whether when you set it up, you had any idea of where it would be today?
Well, I'm always an optimist. I call myself a pathological optimist, which means I need a few pessimists around me to keep me straight. But no, it's bigger than I ever really imagined. We're in over 300 languages. We're in every corner of the world and everybody knows it everywhere. It's pretty amazing.
What are the biggest differences between the world now and the world when you set it up?
Well, I mean, obviously, we've got a very angry and divisive political situation in many, many countries around the world. We've seen this enormous decline in trust, trust in journalism, trust in politics, trust in each other to some extent. And yet, you know, I think a lot of things are still the same. People are still people, and the kind of goodwill and spirit that the Wikipedia community brings is still common all around us.
And is it safe from the threats of AI and the rest of it? Does it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the thing about AI is it makes a lot of mistakes, hallucinates, so to speak, and you can't really trust it for most things. We're keeping a close eye. I mean, it's great if AI gets better, but for now, no, we're happy with things as they are.
And you mentioned trust, and it is a perfect context, really, the world that we've just described for a book that is called The Seven Rules of Trust, Why It Is Today's Most Essential Superpower. And if you hadn't already described yourself as a pathological optimist, I would now. Possibly not quite as pithily, but I would point out that, crikey, that's a big claim you're making, that we can somehow find our way back from the complete denigration of objective truth and the abandonment of trust that seems to typify much of society. Where did the idea of the book come from?
Well, you know, just looking at the world and looking around it with I'm myself a bit of despair about,
yeah,
you know, the state of lack of respect by a lot of our political leaders for trusting the public, for trusting science and so forth, and realized, wow, you know what? Actually, I have learned some lessons over the years with Wikipedia being a very open and trusting system, with going from kind of a joke to one of the few things people trust, even though obviously we're not perfect, and just thought, you know what, people need to really stop and think a little bit about trust, about how do we get back there. And also, I think the public is beginning to demand more trustworthy leaders. I mean,
do you?
I do, I do. I mean, you know, I think...
Some people would argue that they're running at 100 miles an hour in the opposite direction.
Well, there's mixed evidence,
of
we
course,
can say. We can
course.
Say. But, you know, I'm among those who would say, you know, in the last election here, it was as much the Tories losing as it was Labour winning because they had lost the trust.
Yes.
Of the public, you know, the very emotional picture of the Queen at her husband's funeral sitting all alone. And then we find out they're having a party in Downing Street the night before. And you think, we can't trust these people. This is ridiculous, you know, and, tossed them out. Of course, that's just one example, but, I hope that people will say, you know what, actually, let's get serious. Like, and, you know, we also see the rise of political violence, that is, I think, a symptom of coming to view people we disagree with as somehow almost inhuman, like they're not trustworthy partners for compromise and dialogue, and that's terrible.
Well, the analogy I always use is a football pitch, and you could have a game on a football pitch against people that you were your sworn enemies, but you'd all agree on who the referee was, what happened when the whistle got blown, and what the offside rule is.
Yeah.
Do I have to explain the offside rule to you as an American?
No, I'm aware. It's something mysterious that happens from time to time.
But that's what's changed, is that now that someone will lynch the referee, claim that Donald Trump will claim that the goalposts don't exist, and the idea of having an engagement in a traditional sense feels...
Yeah.
Fanciful.
Well, I mean, I think we have to say we're not going to put up with that anymore.
But that's trust, it's isn't just, it? Trust in the institutions almost, and the individuals.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, with the rise of AI and the ability to use it for misinformation or other, you know, nefarious purposes, I do think people are starting to realize, like, oh, actually, that old-fashioned thing called journalism probably matters.
You hope so. And it seems to be coming from self-starting sources and new places, which in a way is a bit like the genesis of Wikipedia, which has come under attack itself, hasn't it? Elon Musk has been probably at the forefront. There was quite a lot of trouble over relatively accurate. One of the things that happened after the appalling murder of Charlie Kirk was that relatively accurate depictions of who he was and what he'd said led to attacks upon people for repeating them.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Wikipedia was in the front line of that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's always, and that's a good example of, I was really proud of the community in terms of very even language, very just trying to matter of fact describe what had happened and who he was and all of that, in a way that's, you know, shouldn't be and wasn't pejorative. If you are uncomfortable with some of the things he said, okay, but those are things he said.
Sure.
You know?
So. And as a self-described advocate of free speech, the idea that you would somehow water it down. How does Wikipedia work? I know that you've answered this question many times, but a lot of people listening to this won't realize what goes on under the bonnet.
Yeah, well, there's this amazing community of people. They're a bunch of geeks, and they're not particularly political, and they're just obsessed with writing the encyclopedia. And, you know, most of the work that goes on in Wikipedia is not around issues that are, you know, culture war and all that stuff. I mean, a lot of the work in Wikipedia is just, I don't know, you know, writing about you know, a war that happened in 1343 and that sort of thing, you know, or obscure bits of chemistry and so on. And that's really who we are as a community. And, you know, it's amazing. Like, I think everybody's probably had the experience of you go to something you think is completely obscure and you realize there's this huge, enormous article documenting every aspect of it. And you're like, who are these people? Like, who did this? And it comes to find out it's just this some nerdy guy somewhere, and he's just been typing away and doing his research and all that, and it's lovely.
It's a passion for truth.
Passion for truth, and just a passion to share knowledge. And also, a lot of times, you know, people say, well, why do you spend all that time doing it? Well, a lot of times they do it for fun. They meet other people with a similar interest, or, you know, if they've done it, you know, you could spend 4 hours on a Saturday afternoon editing Wikipedia, or you might spend 4 hours playing Grand Theft Auto.
Yeah.
And when you go to bed, you might think, yeah, the world's a little better because I edited Wikipedia, as opposed to, well, that was an actual waste of time. I had some fun, but, you know. And so I think there's a lot of that.
And in fact, the desire to make the world a little bit better underpins the new book, The Seven Rules of Trust, as well, doesn't it? Because it's not a sort of academic text. It is, in some ways, a guide to being a better person.
Yeah. I mean, it's focused on trying to think in a really practical way, like how, what are the things that we need to do to build trust? And that could apply to businesses, it could apply to organizations in your personal life, because it does undergird a lot of what makes life great, is being able to trust people and being seen as a trustworthy person.
Can you give us an example? I mean, just in terms of daily interactions of what learning some of these lessons would do to a open-minded reader.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you think about, you know, the way we live our lives ordinarily, you meet 1,000 people and, you know, probably 5 of them are super annoying, but they're not malicious or horrible. But generally, by and large, we do think like most people are decent and most people are positive. And if we can say, okay, well, how do we build on that? Like, how do we say, like, actually, that's great. Like, people should behave in a trustworthy manner, and we should expect that of other people, just to help build a better society, to build better relationships. You know, it's really valuable. I mean, I think about it a lot in terms of teenagers. I've got a couple of teenagers at home, and a big part of the teen years is wanting to go beyond your boundaries and you know, get a little more responsibility. And you have to, as a parent, extend them a little bit of trust. But I always say, extend trust, but tell them that. Say, look, I'm going to trust you. Like, you know, you've asked to do this. I'm going to trust you. I'm going to trust you're going to do the right thing, and I expect you to live up to that. And they often will. They'll be like, yeah, okay, yeah, that's fair, right? As opposed to a lot of families get into a real dark kind of quarrel fight over what you're allowed to do, and you can't make me and all that. And it's like, no, I am going to trust you, but don't violate my trust. Let's be sensible together. And I think you can just have a healthier life if you think in the basis of let's try and trust each other.
So it sounds like a lighter life. You carry lighter burdens if you're trusting people, I think. It's a less stressful existence.
Yeah.
We're sitting down for a full hour shortly to record an episode of Full Disclosure, so consider this an aperitif or a taster. Good. Lawrence has been in touch, Jimmy. He says, off the top of my head, 1343 was the Siege of Calais. But he's probably making that up.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, ministers say Jess Phillips has the full backing of Downing Street after she faced calls to step down. 4 abuse survivors say they would only consider returning to the grooming gang inquiry if the safeguarding minister resigns. She's under pressure to regain control of the process after a series of setbacks. The children's minister, Josh McAllister, told LBC it will get started as soon as possible.
I have a lot of confidence in Jess. There are very few people in Parliament with as much experience that Jess has of working with, listening to survivors.
Why can't you get the inquiry going then?
Well, look, I think it's a great question, and I think the answer is that there are genuinely different views in the survivor community about how the inquiry should be run, who should chair it, what the scope should be.
An officer filmed by an undercover journalist at a police station in London has been sacked. PC Philip Nielsen is one of 10 officers facing accelerated misconduct hearings. Footage released earlier this month showed officers making racist and sexist comments at Charing Cross. England's water companies have chalked up their worst environmental performance on record. The Environment Agency says serious pollution incidents rose by 60% last year. Thames Water, which is beset by financial problems, was alone in scoring the worst rating of just 1 of 4 stars. King Charles and Pope Leo have taken part in a historic prayer service at the Vatican. It marks the first time a British monarch and pontiff have taken part in public prayer together in 500 years. The 2-day visit is intended to boost ties between the Catholic Church and Church of England. Police in London are to use drones to support officers responding to emergencies. The trial will see aircraft sent to crime scenes within 2 minutes to send back information and intelligence. The Met says they offer many of the benefits of helicopters at a fraction of the cost. And the Met Office has scaled back its weather warnings for Storm Benjamin. Yellow alerts for wind and rain now cover a smaller area of the east and southeast of England until mid-afternoon. Weatherman John Ketley says it will still be a windy day.
Well, I'm not surprised that they've downgraded it because they didn't really want to name it in the first place. It was named by the French, Benjamin. And so it's actually been affecting more southeastern parts of England and through the English Channel and now into Belgium and northeastern France. That's where the worst of the weather is. And that stormy weather is moving further east as we go through the day.
In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was at 95.73. That's up 58. The pound buys $1.33 and a euro 15. LBC weather, heavy rain and strong winds persisting for many parts of England and Wales. Drier in the north and west, a high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Sharing intimate photos of her without her consent.
Unwanted touching. Unwanted comments. Unwanted nudes.
Controlling what she can and can't wear.
Controlling who she can and can't see.
Threatening her.
Enough. This is abuse.
If you think it's wrong, act on it.
Call it out, show support, report it.
There are many ways you can safely tackle violence against women and girls. Find out how at gov.uk/enough. If someone is in danger, call 999.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation. Mystery Hour with James O'Brien.
Ah, that's quite apt, isn't it? Because you're obviously not allowed to use Wikipedia to answer questions that come up on Mystery Hour. You're not allowed to use any terms of reference at all. You couldn't even use the Encyclopedia Britannica, which is kind of the equivalent of Wikipedia for people of my age when we were young. But that is the only rule, really. You are not allowed to consult. You have to know. You have to have the knowledge needed to answer the question that you answer. Otherwise, you will not get a Mystery Hour round of applause. If you've no idea what this hour of the radio is, then you should know that you're in for a bit of a treat. Some people ring in with questions, and then other people ring in with answers, which sounds very unremarkable, but you'll be familiar perhaps with newspaper columns that do something similar, and it can be a completely magical experience. It's about the travelling, not the arriving. It's about the process, not the destination. And if you want to join in, then the number remains the same. There's even a prize. My favourite contributor of the week will receive a brand spanking new Mystery Hour board game. Wonderful excitement. Joy unconfined. Fun for all the family. Endless hours of entertainment and illumination. A little bit like the radio feature, but with you. And your loved ones playing, or indeed your hated relatives as well. You can find out more about the game itself at mysteryhour.co.uk, and you can find out the full terms and conditions for the competition at lbc.co.uk. I'll say that again, shall I, with my teeth in. lbc.co.uk. That's proper, that is. That's like terms and conditions. If I don't do that, I can get into trouble. The number you need to submit your question, or indeed to provide an answer that you have to a question that's been asked, is 03456060973. Okay, I'll give you a clue. I'm now going to direct my comments straight to the camera in the studio that I ordinarily either forget or ignore. If I remember it, I ignore it. If I don't remember it, I forget it. I'm now speaking directly to the camera. This is James O'Brien, live on LBC, and also live on TikTok. Oh, my days! Yes! We are streaming live on TikTok. So, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Keith. Thank you. So, if you want to see the variation of facial expressions, there's not a lot else to tune in for. If you want to see a dizzying array of facial expressions ranging from this to this, then you can watch it all unfold live and in real time on TikTok. TikTok, no less. Live streaming on TikTok. Sean's in Liverpool. Sean, question or answer?
Question, please, James.
How excited are you to be live streaming on TikTok, Sean?
I can't tell you just how excited I am, James.
You better not try.
There's
no words. It's extraordinary. Carry on. What's the question?
Right, question is, just a bit of background. 40 years ago, I used to be a barman.
Yeah.
In my youth, as a young buck. And we were always told to pour Guinness in one go, straight up the glass. Took it, you know, a couple of minutes as usual.
Oh, really?
Easiest pint in the world to pour.
Yeah.
You just poured it. Nowadays, though, if you ask for somebody to do that, they look at you like you're telling the world is flat.
Yes.
And a young buck, we had the conversation one night with a lad who's drinking Guinness, and I said, no, it should be poured in one go. That's the way it should be done. I had a way with the bar manager to say, look, can I just prove this point? And she was very reluctant, but finally did allow me to do it. And I proved my point. You pour a pint in two stages or one stages, it's exactly the same. And I've photographed to prove it. I could share it.
Well, I never. So, I'd always presumed you wouldn't get a proper head on it if you did it all in one go.
Exactly, yeah. And I think, and I don't know, that this happened, this change occurred after the White Horses advert. where you really? See the man on a beach and, you know...
Well, I was in Ireland a couple of...
Good things come for those who wait, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So you think it's a marketing ploy rather than...
I think it's marketing. And it really frustrated me even more when I watched House of Guinness recently. And they, in that programme, they try to tie it to, you know, an historical thing that they've done for donkey's years. And I don't believe they have. So
this is a great question.
The question is, does it make any difference whether you pour it in one go or two goes? And ideally, rather than having somebody tied to the brewery industry or somebody with an axe to grind, somebody with a scientific background who can say bubbles in a liquid will form differently if poured in two stages. And as I say that, it just sounds even more ridiculous to believe that. So I'm hoping you can get an answer.
Well, the question I really want an answer to is, if it doesn't make any difference, why do they do it? When did it kick in? I mean, I don't normally allow supplementary questions, but this is a subject very close to my heart, so you can fill your boots on this. and it's not, I mean, so I'm spending quite a lot of time in Ireland these days, and I was in a very old school Irish pub the other day, and there were about 8 pints on the bar waiting to be topped up. They were all lined up on the bar waiting to be topped up.
I think the two things, you know, 40 years is a long time, so most people have forgotten the way they used to pour Guinness.
So that
doesn't help. When I start saying how I did it in my youth, people can't remember that.
No.
20, 40 years ago. But I've noticed now, I've been going to Scotland recently, and in certain bars, and I think it's a Caledonian brand, but they've started pouring their pints of heavy in two stages. I'm going, just give me the beer.
Give me the beer. Give me the beer.
Give me the beer. So I do think it's a nonsense.
We'll find out. Hopefully we'll find out. I mean, I guess you'd need someone. Did you notice anything in House of Guinness that would be worth a mention on this radio programme?
Did I mention anything in it?
Did you notice anything on the programme that would be worth a mention on this programme?
It's a good watch. There's a bloke in it
that looks like my slightly scrawny younger brother.
Right.
Look out for it. Seriously, the number of people that have sent me, he's been in other stuff as well. I don't even know the fella's name, but the number of people that have sent me screenshots from watching House of Guinness is off the charts. Thank you, Sean. Wynn is in Mallorca. Wynn, question or answer?
Question, please, James.
Carry on.
I had a question for you for months, and all of a sudden, 15 minutes ago, I changed it completely from a nautical theme to an aviation one.
Well, I say.
Helicopter pilot captains sit on the right-hand side, where airline captains sit on the left-hand side. Why would that be?
Do helicopter pilots have co-pilots?
Not entirely certain.
But you can fly a plane from the left or the right, can't you? The co-pilot can fly a plane.
Let me ask a question to my cousin who's here on holiday with me.
Okay.
I would like to say I'm asking for him, but he is 62 years old, so I'm not going to get away with that.
No, carry on.
Do helicopter pilots have co-pilots, Mike? Yes, they do.
I don't know that I'm trusting Mike on this one. He said it was a bit glib, I felt. It was a bit quick. So,
He's an RAF veteran.
Pilot in command. So we're talking about... Let's check with Mike, because you don't know the lingo, Win. We're talking about the pilot in command, are we?
Are we talking about the pilot in command, Michael? Yes.
Yeah, that's the lingo, that is, Wynn. That's the correct lingo. I'll tell you that. So the pilot in a command, in a helicopter, sits on the right, and in an aeroplane sits on the left. Why?
Why?
That's it. It's on the board. Enjoy the rest of your holiday, lads. 12:11. Hopefully we can augment it with a correct answer to the question. The reason why I know about pilot in command is because a colleague formerly of this parish has qualified as a pilot relatively recently. If you've been listening to this programme for a long time, you may fondly remember the days when Jones the Engineer pressed the buttons that Keith is currently responsible for pressing. And Jones the Engineer has latterly become Jones the Pilot, would you believe? And he's got 40 followers on his YouTube channel, so it's going brilliantly well for him. And if you want to have a look at Jones the Engineer transforming into Jones the Pilot, then you can go to YouTube and just look up Jones the Pilot. So let's see how many followers. If you get him over 1,000 followers, I think he can start. He starts making a few quid out of his YouTube videos, doesn't he? So we're currently on 40. If you follow Jones the Pilot on YouTube, he could be making money by 1 o'clock today. And I'll give you half of it. Alan is in Slough. Alan, question or answer?
It's a question, thanks, James.
Carry on.
Why don't we have court jesters anymore? Why did they die out? and who was the last one?
That's a lovely question. That's a lovely question. What's the name? Can you remember the name of the famous one?
No, I can't. One was made Archbishop of Canterbury, wasn't he, I believe?
Well, in a sort of fit of eccentricity by a monarch.
I believe so.
There's one that I think the fool, or am I thinking of the actor that played the fool? The fool in King Lear is sort of the sort of classic depiction of the jester in classic drama, isn't it? I'm just trying to think about, yeah. Do we know? I mean, I can't name any, so I don't know when the, I mean, in a way, who was the last one is the question, isn't it?
Well, that's basically the question, and...
Yeah.
You know, with who the current was the last state jester? Of the royals, it might be a good idea to bring them back. I think they need cheering up.
Well, they've got quite a few jesters. It's just unintentional, really, these days, as opposed to as opposed to an actual job description. I like it. I like it a lot, actually. When did we see the last of the court jesters? 03456060973, and that's a topical question as well, because the king is currently in Rome praying with the Pope, which is an extraordinary moment. It's a massive mark of how much the world changes. And I appreciate my upbringing was slightly rarefied. I went to very Catholic schools. I had a very Catholic upbringing. But the idea of an English king, and I say that because I'm going back to Henry VIII, having prayers with the Pope when they were at each other's throats during the Reformation and for many years afterwards is quite extraordinary. And yet I sense in the great scheme of things in the wider world, not a very big deal. It would have been a huge deal 40 years ago, but I don't know that, and it's quite rightly very high up the news agenda, but I just don't know that it is something that's going to float a lot of boats in modern Britain for whatever reason. Most obviously, I suppose, the decline of institutional religion. Thank you, Alan. Mark's in Shoreham by the sea. Shoreham by sea. There's no the, is there, Mark, in Shoreham?
No.
Shoreham by sea. Question or answer?
My question is about folding your arms.
Oh, yes.
Right? So when you fold your arms, you instinctively do it one way, right? So it's hard to explain, but like one up, one down, right? But if you try and do it the other way, it feels very uncomfortable, if not impossible. It's very hard to do. You have to really think about it.
Do you know we're live on TikTok, so people can watch me now experimenting with various modes of arm folding. I mean, that is really what TikTok was invented for, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So,
So what do you do? Which way round do you go? What's on top, the right arm or the left arm?
The left arm is on top. Oh. I'm left-handed.
Oh, well, there you've preempted my theory on why this would be.
Well, that's one of my theories. Is it linked to being handedness, if you see what I mean?
Well, we've only got two.
Is it learned behaviour?
I am right-handed, and my upper arm is right. You are left-handed, and your upper arm is left. So we cannot derive from that conclusive claims.
No, because that's not a big enough sample.
It's not a big enough sample, but it is also, if we were to be statistical, it's a 100% proof. So it's at the same time both incredibly reliable and entirely unreliable. Such is the nature of statistics. Have you never... I can't believe you phoned Mr. Howard with this question and you've never tried it out on anybody else.
Well, I have asked the people, but it's one of those things that however many people you ask, right, you can't get, like, a reliable statistic, right? Because I could ask 10 people and they might all do...
Well, it feels weird. It feels weird when you do it the other way, doesn't it?
It does, and it's very hard to do. You have to really think about it.
You do? Yeah, I almost missed then. How can you miss when you're folding your own arms?
I know.
You can see all this live on TikTok. You can see all this live on TikTok. Oh, here you go. Max has been in touch. I'm right-handed and my upper arm is left. Right-handed. Annette, right-handed. No, loads of people challenging our paradigm here, Mark. This is how science progresses.
Well, your paradigm, to be fair.
You were part of my paradigm.
So the question is...
How is it decided? Yeah.
Yeah. Is it like left-handedness or right-handedness, something you're born with, or is it something we learn as we grow up?
That's a really good question, because it's definitely not defined and decided by whether you're right-handed or left-handed, because my inbox now for the rest of the show, so thanks for that, Mark, thanks a bunch, is going to be full of people sending me messages saying, left over right for me, and I'm a righty. And various other variations on that contribution. And it does feel weird.
About it the other day.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the other day, and I just, it's one of those things you never think about, right? But then when you do think about it, it obsesses you.
Yeah, of course it does. I love it. And now a lot of other people will be similarly obsessed. Mark, great question. Thank you very much. So we've got folded arms, jesters, helicopters and pints of Guinness. That sounds like a recipe for a nice afternoon.
This is LBC.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Okay, are you ready, Will?
Yeah.
You've got accelerator.
So... yeah.
Yeah, got it. Oh, 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 crashing. Round the corner, round the corner, round the corner. Beautiful. This is quicker. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Ooh.
You're copying me now. Rude.
Sophie has the drive it takes to work in adult social care. Do you? Make care your career. Search Care Careers today.
Settle in for those longer evenings with EETV and give your TV and film the ultimate flex.
So I can watch all my crime dramas.
While we've got the Boxing Day footy on.
That's right. Switch up subscriptions with Netflix Now, Discovery Plus, and loads more. All powered by our ultra-reliable full fiber.
Sign me up.
Switch to our award-winning bundles today.
New customers, 62% UK availability, terms apply.
Imagine the varifocal lens of the future, personalized to you, engineered with artificial intelligence and powered by your visual behavior. Experience instantly sharp vision in motion with Varilux XR Pro lenses from Essilor. Find your local optician at Essilor.com and ask for Varilux XR Pro.
Mystery Hour on LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973.
90 minutes after 12 is the time. We don't really do showbiz news on this programme, do we? But this is something that I think you might be interested in knowing. Claudia Winkleman and Tess Daly will step down as the presenters of Strictly Come Dancing at the end of this series. The final show they will do is the forthcoming Christmas special. That's a plum gig that's going to be up for grabs soon. I wonder whose hats might be thrown into the ring for that one. 12:19, Gary Lineker's at a loose end, I'm told. 12:19 is the time. You're listening to Mystery Hour with James O'Brien on LBC. Is there any reason why Guinness is habitually poured in two goes when you're pulling a pint of Guinness? Because Sean is adamant it makes absolutely no difference whatsoever. I'd love to know the unvarnished truth about that. Why does the pilot in command of a helicopter sit on the right and the pilot in command of an aeroplane sits on the left? When did we stop having jesters, court jesters, and why? They'd be great, wouldn't they? And arm folding, what determines which arm goes on top? You fold your arms now. Go on. Thank you. Which arm's on top? Yeah. Why? See? Don't know. We want to know. The number you need, 0345 6060973. David's in Milton Keynes. David, question or answer?
Question, please, James.
In your own time, mate.
You know when it's to do with when actors or presenters, or indeed radio presenters, sort of break character and start to giggle or laugh.
It's the best feeling in the world.
Corpsing.
Yes.
Why on earth is it called corpsing?
I think I know.
Oh.
I think it is because the worst imaginable circumstances in which you would start laughing inappropriately is when you're playing a corpse.
That kind of makes sense, yeah. And I guess you'd know.
Qualifications, schoolboy thespian and student thespian, thespian of many years standing. I think, because it's something I'm sure that's been... I'm not going to give myself a round of applause for that because I don't know. I can't prove it.
You're not rock solid, right?
Not rock solid, but it makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does make sense.
There's
a
Stoppard play.
I'd like to get definitive.
No, of course we'll try and go definitive, but quite a lot of stuff like this, you can't go definitive because it's lost in the mists of time, or there are competing theories. But I'll put it on the board. I auditioned to play a corpse once, and I didn't at the Library Theatre. I didn't get the part. It's incredible, isn't it? The part went to a lovely bloke called Toby. I mean, I got a proper part in the play, so I wasn't that disappointed, but we all quite fancy it. It was a double bill of Tom Stoppard plays at a little theatre in Manchester that's not there anymore called the Green Room Theatre. a beautiful little space, as actors like to say. I think it was on Whitworth Street, just around the corner from the Hacienda. And I know that one of the plays was The Real Inspector Hound, and I can't remember what the other play was, and neither can I remember which one of the two plays in a Tom Stoppard double bill had a corpse in it. But you are on stage for the entire duration of the play. There is a corpse on the stage. And so if you started laughing, it would obviously not be good. I mean, it'd be even worse if you were King Lear carrying Cordelia's corpse onto the stage and you'd go, and Cordelia got the giggles, or if you were Horatio bemoaning the passing of Hamlet at the end of Act 5. What's the line again, Keith? Good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest. And if Hamlet started giggling at that point, it would probably not be good for the general mood. But if there's another answer to the question, I am yet to hear it. David, lovely question. 23 after 12 is the time. We're live on TikTok and Joe's in Nottingham. Joe, question or answer?
Answer, James.
Carry on.
Answering the helicopter question about the why does the captain sit in the right seat?
Pilot in command!
Pilot in command, not necessarily. I mean, it depends on a few things of aviation, as usual.
Okay, go on. I can tell you know what you're talking about, so I'll be quiet.
Well, basically, it depends on the manufacturer of the helicopter that you're talking about. Oh. It's not necessarily the pilot in command. It's whether or not the pilot is the sole occupant of the helicopter, which quite often you usually are.
Yes.
If you're talking about the American helicopters like Robinson, their main fuel tank's on the left-hand side, so if you're on your own, you need to be on the right side to offset that. You could have somebody in your co-pilot seat flying also, but if they get out and you're pilot in command still, you need to be in the right. And there are other manufacturers like Eurocopter where they have, you'll be sitting on the left-hand side and there's nobody on the right-hand side necessarily when you're flying. Or if you're in a multi-crew operation, it doesn't really matter who's sitting in what seat. The pilot in command will be the pilot in command. And
So there's no mystery here, really.
Yeah, it's just one of those caveated sort of questions, really. It depends.
But you haven't mentioned planes. Do we know why an airline captain always sits on the left?
I consider myself a proper pilot, so I couldn't possibly mention anything to do with fixed-wing pilots.
Is there beef between helicopter pilots and fixed-wing pilots? I had no idea.
Just a bit of joshing, really. But, you know, it's, if you can get up and go for a cup of tea in the back, is it really piloting?
Well, kind of. I mean, it is when you're not going for a cup of tea. What else could you call it?
There you go.
I grant you the bit when you're making a cup of tea, you're not doing much piloting, but the bit when you're not making a cup of tea is well, certainly when you're taking off and landing. I'd never thought of that before. So piloting a helicopter is full on, whereas flying a jumbo jet is not.
Every appendage you use when you're flying a helicopter, pretty much. And
no, you don't.
Yeah.
Don't be disgusting.
You know.
Don't be disgusting. It's all caught for... but Jones the pilot, whose YouTube channel is incredibly popular, I'm told. He had as many as 40 followers at 12 noon today, and we'll check how many he's got shortly. Jones the pilot, who tracks his journeys on... he flies a small plane on his own, so he's going to be piloting, isn't he? Even though it's fixed wing, he's not going to be able to put his feet up.
He is as well, but a big difference between a helicopter and a plane is there's a neutral position in a plane. You can pretty much let go, and as long as your wings are level, it's going to stay pretty level. In a helicopter, you have to constantly put in inputs in to keep it going the way you want to go.
Absolutely fascinating. Question or answer? I mean, qualifications.
I'm a commercial helicopter pilot, and I'll be flying helicopter tours over London all weekend.
Oh, great stuff. Have a round of applause.
Thank you.
No, thank you. I've never been in a helicopter. Come on.
Hello?
I said I've never been in a helicopter.
Oh, have you not? Really? Oh, you know, you should potentially do one of your shows from over London, over the River Thames one day.
Absolutely no chance. 26 minutes after 12 is the time. Peter, is it? They wouldn't even let me go up in a crane for insurance reasons. I wanted to do the show from a big old crane and they wouldn't let me do that. There's no way they let me do it now. I thought you were just going to invite me on a freebie. Peter is in Liverpool. Question or answer?
It's a question, James.
Carry on.
So it's a question about hair. So
who?
I was watching about hair.
Who?
Hair.
Sorry. I don't know why I found that so funny. Go on.
Fair enough. So I was watching a documentary about chimpanzees and how similar they are to humans.
Oh, yes.
Okay. And they were talking about a chimpanzee's beard. And I have a bit of a beard myself.
My now, first band was... No, forget it. Carry on.
Okay. So what I notice is that my beard will grow, my hair will grow to a certain length, but chimpanzees, even though they're so similar to us, their hair doesn't, you know, you won't see a big shaggy hairdo on a chimpanzee and a big full beard. And I can only think of a few other animals where their hair actually needs cutting. So dogs, potentially sheep, and they're domesticated. I'm sure there's other animals that need their hair cutting. But it got me thinking, why do some animals have hair that grows and needs cutting?
Yeah.
And why do the majority of animals not have hair that needs cutting? It goes to a certain length, and that's it. So surely there must be some sort of genetic benefit, or maybe it's breeded into certain animals that are domesticated.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could see that with sheep, it was deliberate. Because they wanted the wool, so they would have been, you know, a human intervention probably to maximise the genes that were producing the most wool. Because occasionally they lose one, don't they? You'll see a story from Australia about some sheep who's been found up a cliff with like a massive uncut wool mass all over them. Mm-hmm. But the humans, why would humans?
And dogs. Why would dogs have hair that needs cutting? My dog needs his hair cutting every 6 weeks.
Yeah,
I can't think of many other animals, and I can't see the distinction why some do and some don't.
There might not be one. I mean, I don't know. That you just presume that there'd be some sort of evolutionary explanation. Don't know.
Correct.
I like it. It's a good question, because it annoys me that the dog needs grooming. It's quite expensive as well.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Don't do it yourself.
Well, I know. I've seen that film. All right. So why do some creep mammals, we just confine it to mammals, need haircuts and other mammals don't? 0345 606 0973. What is the origin of corpsing? And it was indeed the real Inspector Hound that featured the corpse that my old friend Toby gave us on the stage of the Green Room Theatre in Manchester in, probably it would have been the summer of Easter of 91, if memory serves. And you're right, Christine's been in touch to say, what's the other one after Magritte? And it was. God, oh, clever bunch. Why do we fold our arms the way that we fold our arms? Favouring one arm. You either have your right on top or your left on top. When did we get rid of jesters? We've gone in on the... What was the name of the nice bloke who answered the helicopter question? Joe. I haven't written his name down. We've done the helicopters. And still, probably the one I'm most interested in, although it's by no means the best question, do you need to pull a pint of Guinness in two goes? Or is it some sort of weird marketing or just a glitch in the matrix that has worked its way into pretty much every pub in the land? Here's Thomas Watts with your headlines.
Sir Keir Starmer has insisted he has faith in Jess Phillips after she faced calls to step down. Four abuse survivors say they would only consider returning to the grooming gangs inquiry if the safeguarding minister resigns. One of the police officers filmed by an undercover journalist at a station in London has been sacked. Footage released earlier this month showed officers based at Charing Cross making racist and sexist comments. England's water companies have chalked up their worst environmental performance on record. The Environment Agency says serious pollution incidents rose by 60% last year. LBC weather, heavy rain and strong winds for many parts of England and Wales. Drier in northern and western areas, a high of 13 degrees.
This is LBC. Listen on the move with the new LBC app.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the journalism industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Molly, a journalism student in year 12.
Outside of the classroom, we run our own news platform called The Loop. I do a daily news bulletin and produce videos for socials. We learn everything we need to be a journalist and have even learned alongside the news team at Global.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
When BP asked me to read the voiceover for their new Wild Bean Cafe ad, I thought I knew what to expect. But when they told me I'd be reading the script next to a mountain waterfall, on horseback, strumming a harp, in a hailstorm, naked, ow, 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 ow. Well, that was wildly unexpected. Just like Wild Bean Cafe having a freshly ground signature espresso blend for everything from Americanos to flat whites in a fuel station. Wowzers. Wild Bean Cafe. Only at BP. Subject to availability at selected BP stores only.
Taxes changing from April 2026.
If you're a sole trader or a landlord,
with a turnover above £50,000,
you'll need to use recognised software to keep records
and send quarterly updates of your income and expenses.
There's no avoiding it. Taxes changing. Get ready. Search HMRC Making Tax Digital.
Welcome our new bookworms to the club. Now, do you read traditional books or e-books?
Oh, real books.
Traditional, always.
Yes, quite.
I read e-books. I adjust it so the font's huge.
They make large font books.
Think bigger. Imagine Moby Dick all cuddled up with a book.
his font size.
Oh, my goodness. Oh.
Maybe it's time for varifocals. At Specsavers, get 2-for-1 varifocal glasses from £110. Conditions and exclusions apply. See online for details.
This is LBC Mystery Hour with James O'Brien. Call 0345 6060973.
It is 12:32. Blackbush to Bodmin is one of the flights that you can enjoy if you follow that YouTube channel that I was telling you about earlier. Very exciting. Not a lot happens, but then again, I'm currently broadcasting a radio show live on TikTok, so I can't really criticise someone who's filmed himself flying an aeroplane. That's arguably better viewing than how many likes did you say, Keith? 11,000 likes already on TikTok. That's extraordinary. Only 600 or 700 people watching it, though. Remember to double tap the screen. That's how you get what a light. Oh, yeah. Right, remember to double tap the screen. Do people need to have a name like Swifties for people who are following this on TikTok? We call them Misties, Mystery Hour fans on TikTok. Do you need to have a name? Hashtag Misties. Are you a Mistie? Hashtag Mistie. Hi, Misties. I'll stop now. Marty's in Belfast. Marty, question or answer?
It's an answer, James. First time I've ever called in with knowledge of an answer. And it's your favourite question so far. It's about the Guinness.
Go on then. What's going on?
Right. The short answer is it makes no difference anymore. However, it did used to. Way back in the, late 1700s or whenever Guinness started brewing the porter as it was then.
Yes.
It was a very flat beer. But they had a separate cask that they had, frothy Guinness. So they would pour most of the pint with the flat and then switch to a different pump to put some froth into it.
Are you serious?
And that's why, yeah. And that's why you used to have two pours at it. And that stayed like that for a couple of hundred years. And it was in the, mid-50s maybe, when they introduced, nitrogen into the Guinness.
I think it would have been the other way round.
Well, it's not.
No, I think they'd have put the frothy one in first.
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah, because...
Do you want to have a fight?
No, but I'll bet you a pound you're wrong.
I'll bet you a pint.
I'll bet you a pint. And if you're ever in Belfast...
Because you do the frothy one, and then do the flat one, and then it would rise to the... No? Okay.
No, you do the flat one first, and then you do the frothy one after at the last bit.
Oh, but
I say now... I mean, you go into a pub in Belfast or Dublin, if the bartender does it in one pour, he's not going to last long. He or she is not going to last long.
Yeah, which is a kind of sense of occasion almost, isn't it? It adds to there's a bit of mystique. Hashtag
it just adds a little bit to, or keeps the tradition going. But from a taste point of view...
I never... Sean was absolutely right then.
Yeah, he was.
It makes no difference. I love it when this happens on Mystery Hour. It never had occurred to me that there was no reason for doing that. I presumed that if you didn't do it, you ended up with all head or no head or something like that.
Yeah, pretty much. If you poured the original Guinness into a glass, there would be absolutely no head on it whatsoever.
Yeah.
But I take it you like the old pint of Guinness.
I do. I mean, it's not what I drink all the time because it can be a bit heavy, can't it, sometimes? Well, actually, you think it's heavy, but it's not. Every first sip of Guinness is a revelation, I find. Because it looks like it's going to be much heavier than it is, but I tend to only drink it when I'm in Ireland now.
Right. Do you ever try the bottled Guinness?
I have tried. It's a sweeter drink, the bottled Guinness.
And it's a lot fizzier as well.
It is a lot fizzier.
I'm not a fan of the bottled Guinness at all. If it was only bottled Guinness, I would drink lager.
Qualifications, Marty?
I have a long-time Guinness drinker, and I send to your producer, I'm nearly sure I heard that story in the Guinness factory in Dublin. But it could have been some old drunkard sitting at the end of a bar. But so it's one or the other, James.
That's good enough for me. Either way. Lovely stuff. Oh, fair play to Sean as well for bringing that one to our attention. I had absolutely no idea. I should never look at it quite the same. But equally, I would never want my pint to be poured in one go. It's like Marty said, it's got an air of, it's got an air to it. It's got a bit of magic to the tradition, to the, what's the word? There's a word for it, isn't there? What would the word be? Ritual. The ritual. There's a ritual to it. Alan's in Liverpool. Alan, question or answer?
Question, please, James.
Carry on, Alan.
Right, around about 12 months ago, I think it was, you did your civic duty.
Well, I didn't.
And went on jury service.
Well, yes, I did go on jury service.
You hoped to.
I didn't get on a bloody jury. I got a few good stories out of it for the radio, though, especially the... Anyway, carry on.
You never mention them.
No, I know. Anyway. I try not to be repetitive. Go on.
But ever since then, I've been wondering, particularly High Court judges... Are they exempt from jury service? Because what if they're working on a really big case, or particularly, say, a fraud case, which can take years? And you can defer once, I know that.
I presume that on those... I mean, I know that when I was at Isleworth Crown Court, they offered you the opportunity to volunteer for a long case. So I don't think that many people end up on... really long cases under duress, and I presume there are some jobs.
High Court judges, are they exempt from jury service?
No, I know what you're asking. I just sort of think, I don't think they are, personally. I've got somewhere in the back of my brain, only the monarch. I don't know where I got that from. I'm probably off some old drunk bloke in the same pub that Marty was in when he heard about how to pull a pint of Guinness. So are judges exempt from jury service? That's a lovely question. I love it, yeah. Have you done it yourself?
No, I'd love to.
Would
I'd
you? To. I can see why. Yeah. I mean, I was quite annoyed at the time because I don't get paid and I was worried about missing more than 2 weeks of radio. I got radar to worry about. But it was actually quite informative. It would have been even more informative if I got on a blimmin' jury. Nice one, Alan. Are judges exempt from jury service? Why do some mammals grow hair while other mammals don't? What is the origin of the theatrical phrase corpsing for when usually you get the giggles on stage? I think I've got that right, but we need ideally an extremely famous actor to confirm that my theory is correct. Why do you fold your arm with one arm on top? Because it's got nothing to do with whether you're right-handed or left-handed. When did jesters disappear from our courts? Probably when courts disappeared, come to think of it, but I again need a proper answer. And we've done the Guinness question. Paul's in Lockerbie. Paul, question or answer?
An answer, James. Hello.
Carry on. Hello.
The last recorded named jester or court fool that I can find or could find when I did research was a man called Dickie Pierce, who was court jester to the Earl of Suffolk, and he died in 1728.
Gosh.
And on his gravestone inscription is still... legible. I can read it for you if you like.
No, I think someone sent it to me, but I'd rather hear you read it.
Now, here lies the Earl of Suffolk's fool. Men called him Dickie Pierce. His folly served to make men laugh when wit and mirth were scarce. Poor Dick, alas, is dead and gone. What signifies to cry? Dickies enough are still behind to laugh at by and by.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it?
Sort of, but it sort of puts the fool in that very vulnerable position of being mocked. There's another reference to an unnamed fool that was employed and is quoted in some sources as the last known fool was employed by the Bowes Lyon family in Strathmore.
The Queen Mother's outfit.
Yeah, and died in the late 1700s, but I could find no name for that. And there was a persecution to death in the 1800s of a man called Dummy in a village in Norwich for staring at children or something like that, and he was known in the village as Dummy.
Oh, that's
but the fools
shame.
The fools died, indeed. It's all very tragic stuff. There was Will Summers.
Will Summers was the one I was trying to think of. Yeah. That's the one that they think the fool was based on, is it? In King Lear?
Henry VIII.
Yeah. He had it.
It was Henry VIII's fool. The big portraits of him and Catherine of Aragon and Queen Elizabeth, and there's a Jane fool in there as well, who is Catherine of Aragon's fool. And Will Summers has a monkey on his back. And although he had an elevated place in court, he was made to sleep with the menagerie of animals.
Good Lord.
And you could say that's where the expression going around with a monkey on your back comes from.
Well, this is fascinating. It'd be too late for Lear. It must have been something else that made me learn about Will Summers. What are your qualifications, Paul?
Well, I'm just a nosy person, but I'm in the middle of trying to write a book, and it's the archetypes of what signifies the early workhouses and people with disabilities.
Oh,
and
no.
The fool is one of the themes I thought I should explore.
That's fascinating.
And so that's a chapter of my book, and those are there's Sexton and his son Patch, and
yeah,
all these people that were dressed up and made to parade around in court in a shambling fashion.
Do we know, I mean, you've got your round of applause for the 1728, but do we know...
Thank you very much.
...why it stopped?
I would say we had the Industrial Revolution started to take place, the confinement of people that became redundant to industry and were confined in workhouses and houses of correction and stuff. And in that way, new money started coming in and the courts became a sort of a social irrelevance in a way.
Of course. The court jester disappeared when courts disappeared, essentially.
More or less. Yeah, as you said. Yeah, more or less.
I would say. What's your book going to be called? You don't have to tell me if you don't jinx it.
I haven't quite decided on it, but it's the biography of an institution.
Sounds fascinating. Yeah. It really does.
Beggarington would be the working title at the moment, which
That's
is
nice.
Actually the field that the old workhouse was built on. It was the last workhouse built in Britain and one of the first to be demolished as well. So
happy days.
And I worked there a long time ago, so that's why I'm writing its biography, because there's nothing left there now.
Absolutely. Have a round of applause on me, and let me know when the book is published, or at least finished.
Thank you, James.
And don't forget about the jester from Leicester for snooker friends, Mark Selby, although I don't think he counts as a court jester. Thank you, Callum. Kathleen's in Upminster. Cheers, Paul. Kathleen, question or answer?
It's an answer.
Carry on.
Thank you. It's an answer to the judges being, yes, they're not exempt anymore. They were, as were a number of like civil servants and things that were exempt. But they lifted it. Don't ask me when, but it was quite some time ago. Don't ask me when. It was a long time ago because I was working at the Royal Courts of Justice then. Gosh. But shortly afterwards, it was quite amusing because the Lord Chief Justice himself was called.
Wow.
And I can't imagine what it must have been like for the other jurors.
No. Well, all for them. Be a bit of a busman's holiday.
He wouldn't have declared it, I suppose.
No, I suppose not.
Being in a jury with the Lord Chief Justice himself.
Well, it'd be like mischief. Someone would have said, what are your qualifications? And he'd have said, I'm the Lord Chief Justice. So what are your qualifications? I know you've told us, but just for the formalities.
I was just a clerk at the Royal Courts of Justice, working with High Court judges.
Just a clerk? You weren't just a clerk. You were an essential cog in the wheels of British justice, Kathleen.
I can tell you, without a judge, yes, but we were just the clerk. Were we the clerks?
There'd be no judging. Round of applause for Kathleen. Lovely stuff.
Take care.
Thank you. I got loads of questions about juries, but it would be inappropriate of me to use this opportunity to ask them. 12:45 is the time.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
King Charles and Pope Leo have prayed together in the Sistine Chapel. Historic, for sure. But what should Charles be praying for? Deliverance? Forgiveness?
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
Taxis changing. From April 2026.
If you're a sole trader or a landlord,
with a turnover above £50,000,
you'll need to use recognised software to keep records
and send quarterly updates of your income and expenses.
There's no avoiding it. Tax is changing. Get ready. Search HMRC Making Tax Digital.
There's some naughty folks out there in cyberspace, and it can be tough to tell a legit deal from a dodgy one. That's why you need Bitdefender, your very own digital heavyweight, working silently behind the scenes to keep you and your devices safe. Whatever threats the web throws at you. Trusted by the experts, used by the pros.
Bitdefender, a global leader in cybersecurity. Trusted, always.
Verify now at bitdefender.com.
Big motoring world.
Yes, that's right. Big Motoring World is also Wow Motoring World because we price check our cars every day to guarantee you our best price with up to 95% of them below market value. Big Motoring World. We're big on what matters to you. See website for nearest store. Visit bigmotoringworld.co.uk or one of our stores for our price promise and terms and conditions.
Imagine the varifocal lens of the future, personalized to you, engineered with artificial intelligence and powered by your visual behavior. Experience instantly sharp vision in motion with Varilux XR Pro lenses from Essilor. Find your local optician at essilor.com and ask for Varilux XR Pro.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Mystery Hour with James O'Brien. This is LBC.
You send me the loveliest things sometimes. You really do. There's a footage of an old BBC archive. The last pub in Belfast to use two barrels to pour a pint of plain. Guinness was done in exactly the same way. And I'll share that on Blue Sky in case you want to see it. Thank you to Nick for sharing it with me. I think, and I haven't double-checked, but a couple of you are telling me that I am owed a pint by Marty in Belfast because I was right, you put the froth in first, which just made sense to me. I could be wrong. But I've shared that if you want to have a look at it. I'm now, of course, also live on TikTok. A lot of people apparently keen to see the real star of the show. So here you go. This is just for the TikTokers. It's absolutely real. And don't forget to hit pop. What? Keith, stop saying stuff. Tap the screen to like. Honestly, it's so exhausting being an influencer. Oliver's in Portsmouth. Oliver, question or answer?
Hi, James. I've got an answer to the helicopter question.
Oh, no. Are you challenging the bloke who answered it before, Joe?
Yeah, it's a bit of a yes and. There's a lot
Oh, that's
more
fine,
to it,
then.
Really.
All right, go on, then.
So, you have two sticks when you're flying a helicopter. You have the cyclic stick, which is the sort of forward, backwards, lefty, righty one. And then you've got the collective stick, which is up and down.
Yes.
So the way that people's brains work is sort of if you're right-handed, you need to have more control within your right hand. So that's why you use that stick. And on smaller helicopters,
okay,
they used to share the collective stick.
Yeah.
So there would be one in the middle. So the pilot, obviously, is
sit on the left
in charge. So he wants to sit on the right and use his left hand on that collective. And
yeah,
the co-pilot sits on the other side.
So, I mean, it gets turned upside down a bit if you've got a left-handed pilot, but the general reasoning is that you want your right hand doing the more controlling one.
Well, as a left-handed person, I can tell you the world is set up for the right-handed people.
It certainly is, mate. You should try being a woman.
Yeah.
Qualifications, Oliver?
I was an RAF engineer for 20 years.
Fantastic. Well, that'll do. I've really enjoyed this question. Round of applause for Oliver. Will's in rugby. Will, question or answer?
Hello, it's a bit of an addition, actually, to the helicopter question.
Oh, come on, I've got loads of things that need answering. Why are we doing three on the helicopter? Go on, then. No, it's not you. I'm criticising my colleagues, Will, not you. Carry on.
No, that's okay. It's about the other side. It's about airline pilots.
Oh, okay. No, that's interesting.
So, it goes back to, like, the dawn of aviation, really. You know, airplanes originally, of course, had propellers on the front of them. As they turn, they create a bit of a leftward sort of motion for the airplane, dragging the airplane to the left.
Okay.
So turns to the left are easier. So traditionally, when we fly a pattern around an airport land, all the turns are to the left-hand side. So the pilot sits on the left so that they can see the runway. Obviously, that we have multi-crew operations, obviously there's a second pilot, which is myself. I'm a first officer, and we sit on the right-hand side. It's also why boarding happens from the left-hand side.
This is great. I love this. I apologise for being so sort of snarky when you came on. What are your qualifications?
I'm an airline pilot for a major British airline.
Oh, do nicely.
Currently in my uniform, actually, waiting to go flying.
I think everyone should be in their uniform when they ring me, frankly. I said just respectful.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just, pilot in command! Pilot in command! Do you follow Jones the Pilot on YouTube?
I do not know, but I am going to.
Are you? Why?
Yeah, why not?
Well, he does. He's a complete small fry compared to you. He's just tootling around the place in the sort of aviation equivalent of a chopper bicycle.
They probably do more work than us, though,
Well, you may enjoy it. You may enjoy it. He's done a lovely job. He's edited it all up as well. I had quite a few of you are pointing out that... Oh, round of applause for Will. That when Jones the Engineer worked on this programme and we announced his departure, he was going off to be a professional poker player. He hasn't set a YouTube channel up about that. Jack's in St John's Wood. Jack, question or answer?
I've got an answer.
Carry on, Jack.
It's a bit of a boring one, I'm afraid, but you're 100% right about corpsing.
Are you an extremely famous actor?
No, I'm sorry to disappoint, but my mother...
Are you a mildly famous actor?
No, but my family are all theatre types. Okay. My mum was a West End actress, and my dad was a producer and a director and stuff.
Lovely.
So
lovely.
I was brought up surrounded by it all. But you're right, corpsing just is in relation to the fact that that's the worst time to laugh, and it's probably the time you're going to laugh when you're playing a corpse on stage.
It's just someone breaks wind and the whole thing falls apart, really, doesn't it? Or something like that.
There is a meaning that people have tried to sort of stitch onto it, which is that, you know, you kill the character metaphorically when you laugh on stage, i.e. you corpse the character, but that's an American thing. It's a bit more modern.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Occam's razor, it's bound to be. It's the worst imaginable time you can laugh inappropriately on stage. It's when you're supposed to be dead. Qualifications, you've already told us, a theatrical family. Round of applause.
Exactly.
Lovely stuff. Thank you, Jack. 12:53 is the time. I just keep getting my things up to date. So we've done a lovely answer on the jesters, wasn't it, from Paul? We haven't done the arm folding. We've done the corpsing, thanks to Jack. We haven't done the hair. And we've done the judges and the juries, thanks to Catherine. Craig is in Cannock. Craig, question or answer?
Hi, James. It's an answer.
Carry on, Craig.
The hair question.
Lovely.
There's two parts to it. Firstly, you've got the evolutionary part, where the hair, we'd say, for example, tigers, wolves, etc., it would have been, over the course of however many years, genetically advantageous to have the hair at a certain length, for example, because of the temperature of the area that the animal lives in. It could be down to, for example, humans, if you like, our hair, which would be effectively plumage, potentially granted an evolutionary advantage. So as we lost the hair on the other parts of the body, make it the sort of length of hair on a beard or the hair on the head would grant be more likely to be wanting to the other sex breed with you.
Fair
on
enough.
That side of things. Hair generally would fall out when it reaches a certain sort of weight, according to the size of the pores, etc., and that side of things. But the other side of it is as well, where you've got animals that need to be have the hair cut, like, for example, dogs and that side of things, it's often down to breeding. So you breed the dogs for the primary characteristic they wanted, historically, and then you'd get other things that would come in, unfortunately, as a byproduct, that you would have to deal with through, for example, cutting the dog's hair to make it so they could see properly.
And that's I mean, some human intervention, some evolution, and some probably just nature. Some sort of dumb.
Exactly.
I love it. Qualifications?
Yeah, I did a biochemistry degree with a specialism in genetics.
That'll do nicely. Round of applause for Craig. For a story on the front of one paper today, going, my husband has a hair transplant. Will it save our marriage? And I thought, could you imagine being married to someone who wants you to have a hair transplant in order to save the marriage? I suggest the marriage might already be in quite a lot of trouble if that is the criteria that you think might save it. But anyway, I digress. Sharon's in High Wycombe. Sharon, question or answer?
It's an answer, James.
Carry on.
It's the answer to the arm folding thing.
Oh, good stuff. Carry on.
Well, as far as I'm aware, because I used to teach this when I was teaching genetics.
Oh, yes.
And I get the kids to fold their arms, and some fold their arms, you know, either way round. So it's just genetic variation. My husband would argue differently with me. He'd say it might be something to do with the womb, you know.
Right.
She's also a biology teacher.
Well, I don't know. I mean, so in terms of genetic variation, there's no particular reason for it. It's just some of us come out like that and some of us don't.
It would be to do with what alleles you inherited.
What allele? What?
Alleles are a different form of a gene. So you, in a gene, you've got different. You've got usually just two alleles, sometimes more.
Okay. So, but so just dumb. I mean, not quite dumb luck, but nothing.
It's just just variation, just like eye colour, whether you can roll your tongue or not, or whatever.
All right, done. Yeah, qualifications.
Retired biology teacher.
Round of applause for Sharon.
Thank you, but James,
oh, yes?
You are still using osmosis in the wrong.
Your band.
Experience.
You're banned.
You're still
banned.
Using it.
You're banned. Why are you still talking? I just banned you. You
right,
have to
okay,
wait for
Sheila.
You can talk to Sheila, but that's it. You're never coming on the show again. Thank you very much and good night. Sharon, thank you. Jones the Pilot is all one word for people struggling to find him on the old YouTube. We're currently live on the old TikTok. This is like a multimedia magnificent extravaganza. So Jones the Pilot, all one word. And then you can see him flying from Bushmills to Bodmin or something. Kevin's in Dundee. Kevin, question or answer?
Answer.
Carry on.
About the Guinness question.
Oh, no.
There is a difference if you pour it in one or if you pour it in two.
Really?
Yeah, mainly because the Guinness font, the handle, is made exactly the same way for every Guinness font.
Yeah.
Now, you need to fill the glass up to the bottom of the glass harp, the gold harp on the glass.
Yeah.
And then you let it settle. And then when you go back to it, you push the handle backwards on the Guinness font. Because when you pull it forward for the first pour, it releases much more gas in the pour.
But why do you have to let it settle?
Because there's 300 million bubbles in it. But if you poured it in one shot, you'd get a head about an inch and a half high.
No, but you pull it up to the bottom of the glass and then you push it straight away. You don't have to wait and you'd get a normal pint.
Nope.
Oh, this is mad, man. Because everyone else, I've said,
there's less gas when you push it back a second time once you've let it settle, and you could get a nice head and it leaves a slight dome on the top of the glass.
So, I mean, how big a difference are you going to tell between a one-pull pull and a two-pull pull?
Probably about half an inch ahead.
It's not a lot, though. Hang on, I'm on TikTok. I'm just showing. Yeah, that's a very good point as well, actually. And then you get some abomination using a knife to scrape it off the top.
Correct.
And that should be a capital offence. I'm just showing people on TikTok what half an inch is, in case they're wondering. There we go.
Okay.
Qualifications?
I was at the Guinness factory on Saturday in Dublin and did a course on how to pour a perfect Guinness.
How long did that course last?
About 15 minutes.
A round of applause for Kevin. It can't be a course. That's not a course. A course has got to be more than 15 minutes, hasn't it? There's a question for next week. How long does something have to be to qualify as a course? That's not a course. That's it from me for today. Who are we going to give the... I'm going to give it to Paul, who answered the jester's question. Because, I don't know, it was just... I just am, because I can, and it's my game. If you miss any of today's show, you can listen back on catch-up on our free Global Player, the new LBC app. You can stay up to date on the top stories and all the rest of it. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Asma Mir, in for Tom Swarbrick at 4, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. A couple of big stories keeping our eye on and discussing this afternoon. Not least, how safe is Jess Phillips in her role as safeguarding minister? But I want to start with this, extraordinary, fascinating, historic moment taking place in Rome. King Charles and Pope Leo praying in the Sistine Chapel. It's without doubt an historic moment, but I wonder, is Henry VIII, the first Supreme Governor of the Church of England, spinning in his grave? We can't read the king's mind, of course, but Rome has a way of concentrating the mind when it comes to, matters spiritual and ethical. In a terrible week for royal reputations, what should the king be praying for? Clarity? Deliverance, perhaps, from his brother? Forgiveness from us? What should the king be praying for?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, Sir Keir Starmer says he has confidence in Jess Phillips and Baroness Casey to lead the national inquiry into grooming gangs. Four abuse survivors say they'd only consider returning to the panel if the safeguarding minister steps down. She's under pressure to get the review back on track. Conservative frontbencher Sir James Cleverly has rejected claims the Tories are playing politics.
Our job is to hold the government to account. We feel very strongly that they have not conducted this well or professionally at all. They delayed, they did everything to try and avoid a national inquiry. Unfortunately, there have been accusations of bad faith applied towards us.
A Met police officer has been sacked after being secretly filmed making racist comments and glorifying the use of force. PC Philip Nielsen was dismissed without notice at an expedited gross misconduct hearing this morning. LBC's Fraser Knight attended the hearing earlier.
The documentary had included footage of PC Nielsen boasting to colleagues about using excessive force against a teenager. He'd claimed that Muslim people cause the most crime and said a revolver would be so nice to deal with a detainee who'd overstayed their visa. The Met said his actions were abhorrent and damaged public trust as he was sacked without notice. Fraser Knight, LBC in Sutton.
A former paratrooper known as Soldier F has been cleared of two counts of murder and five of attempted murder on Bloody Sunday. A judge said the evidence against the veteran fell well short of what was required for a conviction. He was accused of killing James Ray and William McKinney in Londonderry in 1972. Three men have been arrested in London on suspicion of assisting Russia's intelligence service. The group, who are all in their 40s, were detained this morning under the National Security Act. Counter-terror officers are leading the investigation, with the men being questioned at a police station in the capital. And the King has become the first British monarch to pray publicly with the Pope in almost 500 years. The heads of the Anglican and Catholic churches have been meeting at the Vatican. Charles has always been keen to build bridges between the two, almost five centuries since the Reformation. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up 59 points at 95.74. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.15. LBC weather, strong gusty winds in the south and east this afternoon, rain gradually clearing for eastern England, sunny spells with a few scattered showers in the north and west, a high of 13 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Isn't the music you normally expect to hear at the Vatican, but this morning it was played to welcome King Charles and Queen Camilla as they arrived at the Vatican to head to the Sistine Chapel, where they took part together with the Pope in a prayer service. They're going on to a different location for another service that will be more personally directed at King Charles, and we'll report on that a little later as well. I find this fascinating. I was rereading some of my history last night, actually, just to remind myself of various elements of it that I hadn't really touched on since school days. And there is such a lot in this meeting, I think. I mean, you know, a lot of it is diplomatic niceties, but they matter. those diplomatic niceties matter. And like I said just a moment ago, I guess depending on your sensibility, but we do know that the King, King Charles, very much has a religious sensibility and a Christian sensibility. Rome has a way of concentrating the mind, I always think, particularly on bigger issues, matters spiritual, eternal. They don't call it the Eternal City for nothing. But this week, when you set these events alongside the trouble that the House of Windsor is in at the moment because of Prince Andrew, when you set these events alongside it, it's potentially two things. It's either very jarring or it's some kind of balm. And I think which it is depends entirely on how King Charles responds to this meeting and that prayer and these events and the service to come this afternoon as well. Because I was reminding myself last night that at Westminster Abbey, the scene not that long ago of King Charles's enthronement, of his coronation, was originally, and for 500 years or so, a Catholic abbey. It was called, believe it or not, St. Peter's Abbey. It was called St. Peter's. Hasn't been called St. Peter's officially anyway for a long time. And it was one of the few abbeys that King Henry VIII didn't trash. God bless him. And I wonder, I mean, who knows what Henry VIII would make of this, but my guess is if you can spin in your grave, he'll be spinning in his grave about this. The man who founded the role of Supreme Governor of the Church of England, in order to break with Rome, in order to remove any foreign power from religious worship in this country, sees his successor, many centuries on, sees his successor, still the Supreme Governor of the Church of England, enter the Sistine Chapel, of all places, and pray with the Pope. I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing, because at the very least, and there's nothing least about it, it's a representation of Christian unity. But if you look back to the history of the kings and the popes, I do think it's not just dry history. I think there's a lot in it that we can move wholesale into our modern life and particular issues in our modern life and take a reading on those modern issues through the lens of all of that history. And what I mean by that is in the 1600s, in the 1500s and the 1600s, so the 16th century and the 17th century in this country, there was incredible, tumultuous change, not least the change brought about by King Henry VIII and then subsequently a century later by the execution of Charles I, then Charles II, James II, the last Catholic monarch in England, not just about the monarchy and the papacy, but society itself was being revolutionised in England and wider Britain. And I think there's something of that now, not just in religious terms, but definitely also in religious terms.